Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Hello.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
Mikhail Mednani.
Hello.
And welcome back, Hayes Madsen.
Hello.
Yep, so this is Hayes's, I believe, third time on the podcast. He was on the podcast a couple times last week to cover games like Assassin's Creed
last year.
Outer Worlds 2. Sorry, last year. Thank you, Adam. Brain going slower than my mouth. Last year. Chow is not here. He was just feeling under the weather, so he's taking the week off. So the reason why we have Hayes on the podcast this week is because our first, you know, point of course for this week's episode is to talk about the, did it release technically today? Like the embargo lift and released just, you know, within
Friday, technically, podcast yesterday.
Yesterday at the time of recording of Pragmata. The embargo release lifted a few days before formal release. So Hayes covered Pragmata for us for the site, wrote up a review up on rpgsite.net. So he's going to lead the discussion on thoughts on that game. I know others like James and Mikhail and a little bit of Josh have also been playing it. So we'll have a back and forth about that. And then we've got a full slate of other games that we're going to talk about this week. We're going to talk about Mongol Stardive a little bit, potentially Dose of Divas. I might tag a tiny bit about Gothic, the original. I'll tell you why in a moment. But without further ado, we're going to talk about Pragmata. So I'm just going to hand it off to Hayes just to start the discussion, to talk about his review, his thoughts, his impressions. And we'll go from there in terms of, you know, what James and others have thought, touching on that game as well. So just tee us up, Hayes, about what Pragmata is, what your thoughts were, and how you came to write a review for us on RPG Site.
Yeah, for sure. First off, like, general thoughts is that I really like it, and I feel quite similar about Pragmata as to how I felt about Exoprimal and Kunitsugami, which is, it follows in that legacy of, like, Capcom's really experimental new IPs. And if, you know, if for anyone who's not familiar, the gist is essentially like you play as Hugh, who is this systems engineer who's sent to the moon to figure out what's going on with this rogue AI on like a lunar facility in the near future. And stuff hits the fan, obviously. And you meet this girl named Diana, who's essentially like an AI construct who can hack into the different systems of the lunar base. And the really like unique element of Pragmata, as I'm sure most people have seen, is that combat system where you're mixing like traditional third person shooter mechanics with this hacking mini game, where it's, I guess it's hard to explain over audio, but like, you know, you have a grid that pops up when you aim at enemies and you use the D-pad to like navigate through that grid and activate different nodes.
So the you face can buttons, open... not the D-pad.
Yeah. Oh, face yeah. buttons. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So that you can open up enemies and then do more damage to them. So it's like this juggling act where you're doing normal, traditional third-person shooter stuff, using weapons and dodging and all that, but also doing this hacking minigame at the same time. And that's really like what drives the game, in my mind. What really makes it something special is that that combat system feels great from the start, but it does some really, really fun things in advancing it. There's really unique weapons that it gives you. It adds different nodes that you can add onto the hacking minigame. Has like really good enemy variety. And I think my biggest fear going into Pragmata was that that gimmicky kind of combat system might not carry through the whole experience. And it absolutely proved me wrong. Like, it is fantastic. And then I think the other element that makes Pragmata really special is that relationship between Hugh and Diana. And, you know, the overall narrative, as I'm sure a lot of people have seen in reviews, is not simple. It's intentionally simple. It's not striving to be this really complex character study kind of story, but it there's kind of beauty in that simplicity, I think, how it focuses in on this relationship with Hugh and Diana and takes a really surprisingly hardline stance on like the positivity of adoption. Like that is really an element that surprised me. Because you learn very early on that he was adopted, and that becomes a big recurring theme. And just this kind of, like, budding relationship with him and Diana, and there's been a lot of discussion of, like, the sad dad game and everything, and but this is a game where, like, theoretically, you know, you have a found family story where he was acting as a father figure to Diana, but it's a dad story where, like, the best way I've seen other people say it is, like, a dad that likes his kids. And that is kind of refreshing, which is kind of odd to say, but, you know, so many of the dad stories in video games are darker. It's about, you know, this antagonistic relationship almost. But Pragmata is just, like, it has this optimism to it. The way I described it in my review is it feels almost like Pixar-esque. It has this really unique setting and this unique idea, and this just, like, layer of optimism to everything. And that's kind of, like, that's the overall gist that I can give.
Yeah, I agree with you a lot of the, in terms of, like, general takeaways. Like, I'm sure you checked it out last year's SGF, and that was first playable. Over there. Like, me, Adam, and James got to test it out too, and we're like, wow, there's really something to this grid system. But, like, you, I think many people shared that same fear, like, will it get repetitive? And I think one of the ways that, like, I'm still fairly early on in the final release, like, I'm about to get to the end of the second level, but one of the early things that makes you see the potential in the system already is, like, you're introduced to this big enemy, and it has, like, a, since it's a big enemy, it has a fairly expansive grid to hack through, but there's, like, a defensive system that it has on its face where it has, like, four red blocks on it that, like, make hacking it impossible. And to set up context for people, like, your weapons do very little damage unless you, like, hack a thing to leave them in an open state. And then once they're in an open state, you can get, like, real critical damage in there to take their life bars down fairly quickly. But this big enemy starts pulling up, like actual, like, shields where you can't hack it. So you have to physically shoot at those first before you can start that hacking minigame. And as you're shooting those separate blocks off, it actually opens up, like, that portion of the grid in real time, as you're interacting with both the hacking and the shooting, like, almost in an asynchronous manner to make it so you can do what you need to do to it, which is, like, oh, that's a really neat way to visualize this system and the way that, like, you start, you know, getting upgrades and the putting debuffs on enemies through that hacking minigame is, like, really cool. And also, I wonder if the story will go more into this direction, but since I just, like, it's fresh in my mind, there's, like, you know, fairly early on in the story, as you mentioned, when you're getting to the lunar base, and it has, like, a lot of, like, very sci-fi elements to it, obviously, but one of the things that really stuck out to me about the world setting it's trying to tell is this Luna filament that they emphasize, and how it's basically a big 3D printer that is, you can basically replace, like, any material, like, almost instantly. So, like, when you're in the beginning cutscene, some parts of the space station or facility are starting to wear and tear and get thrown off. So they don't even bother to, like, get that debris and try to get it on. It's like the 3D printer will just instantly just
print new things.
Yeah, print new things instantaneously. They're like, and then they mentioned before Hughes, you know, buddies kind of get murked at the very opening parts of that game, that it's cheaper for them to just instantly replace it with this 3D printer. Sure, it's, like, it's less durable and a little bit cheaper, but because of the time and efficiency, you can just instantly replace it. And then, so who cares about, like, the durability if you can just, like, instantly replace it? And then I just recently came across this log in the game where there's this scientist talking with his wife, of Japanese descent, and this conversation goes into, like, oh, you know, about this certain wood in Japan that can, like, withstand over 1,000 years, you know, like, it's, like, very durable, very reliable. It got me thinking, I'm like, I wonder if the story will start going to this. I don't expect it to be the main focus of the game. Obviously, it's the main focus between Hugh and Diana. But I wonder if there's something within the scientific context in that game that's, like, speaking to, like, this conversation between like cheap but easily replaceable versus like durable but maybe more costly or more difficult to get, but it's more reliable. I'm like, I kind of hope like the as I read more logs in that game that it starts opening up conversation like that's like, oh, that's a really interesting thing to think about.
One interesting thing that the game itself doesn't explicitly say, but there was like a conversation about it like a few weeks ago that so they designed certain areas and assets in the game to feel like it was AI generated, even though it was like actually like handcrafted. Mm-hmm. Like they explicitly did that to kind of try and hit that vibe, considering that most of the stuff in this environment has been crafted by like the AI, like computer IDIS, which I think is interesting.
It's cool because, you know, like you said, that main narrative is really focused on Hugh and Diana, but the data logs that you get, and, you know, you can pick up dozens and dozens of little data logs that you can read and little audio logs, essentially. And that's kind of where it starts diving into a little more of like the thematic meat of it. And like you said, it does touch on like, you know, element of cheap manufacturing. Like, and that's a real world issue too, where we have cheap manufacturing that foregoes quality for mass producing things. And there's an element of, you know, you'll see people talk about, there is an element of using AI to streamline things and how that removes the humanity from the process. And I'm not going to say that this is a game that like really heavily tackles Gen AI or anything. But there is an element of that, of like the importance of the human element to creating things, even like manufacturing, like how that human element is still important. I think the other thing that 3D printing kind of theme does for the game is adds a really kind of like nice diversity to the locations that you're visiting. Okay. It's like, you might think, you know, you're on the moon, so you're going to be doing a lot of moonwalking kind of thing, a very same science facility kind of thing. Because you have this 3D printing element, it allows Capcom to kind of like have a lot of fun with environmental design. So you have one section that's like themed after Times Square in New York. And then you have one that's themed after like a really, you know, dense forest. And so you have these very different environments that you're going through that are really refreshing for this kind of sci-fi game, especially like one set in space.
Yeah, I already really, really dig the level design this early on in the game. Because it like, even though it's like fairly linear in how you progress, it's just actually like stages that you're progressing through, which is like, you know, pretty nice and refreshing, all things considered today's landscape. But like, there's a lot of verticality to the movement and to the level design that I really enjoy, because like, even though you have a linear path, it's still open enough to explore and like find like, you know, upgrade materials and hidden stashes and stuff like that. And even the structural design is like non-uniform, like that Times Square location that you mentioned, like, because like it doesn't conform to like structure as we know it, because sometimes like entire like interiors could be like on its like side, so like, you know, the dinner table and the chairs are like on the wall instead because of the way that like things happening in this facility, the way that the Luna filament interacts with things, like it kind of just messes with the structure and like how you like with how gravity is supposed to work. Doesn't really, you know, seems to apply to like what the environment is like showing. It's like, oh, like I'm navigating this like building, and then like these things that I expect to be on the ground are like not on the ground, or like on the ceiling, on the roof. Okay, this is kind of weird, great.
Yeah, it plays with perspective a lot in really fun ways, and kind of like almost procedural generation idea, but like something messed up halfway through the procedural generation, right?
Yeah.
Mikhail, you've been touching on this game as well, right?
Yeah, I, so like, you know, you mentioned the embargo and how it was like a few days earlier, but there's like a bit more to that story. So, Capcom started doing this a bit like, I think it was maybe for Monster Hunter Stories 3 was the first time I noticed it, where actually before that, you know, when Monster Hunter Rise came to PC, they did this thing where you couldn't do like compare different platforms until like either launch day or like close to launch. It was separate from the review thing, and they've started doing this for a lot of games. So with Pragmata, what happened is the review embargo specifically said you can't compare different GPUs, you can't compare different platforms and stuff. So I had to like figure out how to do my coverage, because like I was gonna handle the platform comparison for us, right? But I decided to take it in another angle. The most important port from my perspective was the Switch 2 version, because it's like a new Capcom big game coming there day one. So I decided to focus on that for when Hayes' review went up. So the Switch 2 version, it's like it has the Capcom, like what they've been doing for a long time. They just leave the frame rate uncapped. And this is like, they did this with Monster Hunter Stories 2 on Switch 1, and that led to it being a fantastic experience on Switch 2. But I'm not really fond of, or not like not happy with them doing the same thing here, because I don't want them to release Switch 3 games on Switch 2. So essentially the Switch 2 version, when you play docked, it's pretty good, I'd say, all things considered. But handheld is like a mess. Like, I wouldn't even recommend it for handheld play. And if you're one of the people who has like a Switch 2 and any other platform, and you're going to play it on your TV mainly, why would you even play it on the Switch 2 in the first place? So that was my takeaway from the first article I did. For the second thing, I did the whole platform comparison thing. And now that I have a PS5 Pro, I also include that. And I think Pragmata is one of the biggest upgrades from like PS5 and Xbox to PS5 Pro, because I don't know if I think Hayes played it on base PS5, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Did you play it in the quality mode or in the performance mode?
I did performance, because I usually do performance. I mean, I fiddled around with quality a bit, but I typically focus on performance modes.
Okay, so the quality mode basically is, it feels like it's made for people who have VRR displays. Because it's like always under 60, but it's not a locked 60. So like, I can understand, even I would have done performance mode, because it felt perfect when I played it. But the PS5 Pro version is like a massive upgrade. Like even in the high frame rate mode, which has a 120 FPS target, it's obviously like another uncapped thing, but that looked dramatically better than the PS5 version. And then the default quality mode, it literally looked like I was playing a cross-gen game on PS5 for the first time. It was a massive upgrade. And beyond just the technical stuff, my favorite thing about the PS5 version is the DualSense features. Like, it has the haptics when you're moving the hacking cursor using the face buttons. It has adaptive triggers for the guns. It even has the light bar, which like Josh wasn't a fan of on the PS4 controller, but on PS5 controller, it's really good. And it has gyro support, which is well implemented, so I appreciate that. So like, my takeaway in the end was like, while it may be obvious to some people that, oh yeah, the most powerful console handles it better, but I think the difference is notable enough. So like, if you're curious about how it is, like, I have a lot of comparison images over there. And it's a bit weird that Capcom just left the frame rate uncapped on Switch 2, because if they had given a 30 FPS cap option, I would have just said, yeah, play it on Switch 2. It's a good portable experience. But right now, if you want a stable frame rate, you have to play it on a PC handheld. And the Steam Deck doesn't have DLSS. It has FSR. And FSR doesn't look as good. So you're getting a slightly blurrier image, but it feels better to play. Or if you play it on Switch 2, you get slightly better visuals, but it just does not feel good at all. And I've seen a lot of people say that, oh, VRR makes it good on Switch 2, but it absolutely is not working at all, or not working correctly, from what I can tell. Like, I did slow motion capture just to check. It just does not look or feel good handheld at all on Switch 2. But as for the game itself, I'm happy to eat crow on that, because I kept thinking it'll be one of those games which people just hype up and it just doesn't end up doing anything for me. The demo was like a good taste of it being a good game, but I think now that I've played like I'd say about like 4 or 5 hours of the full game, like in one save, besides like testing it like 1,000 times on platforms, I think it's really good. Very happy with it. And the stage structure is probably my favorite aspect of it, because it just like, I can just do a stage or parts of a stage, take a break and do something else. So I'm very happy with that.
I guess to provide context on when you mentioned me about the controllers, because I'm playing it on PC and I use the DualShock 4 for PC. Some people don't remember that the way that the light bars work on DualShock 4, the DualShock 5 is pretty different, because DualShock 5, you have to light up the touchpad on it for your light. While DualShock 4, like the light bar was like this, like kind of big sort of triangle by the mini USB port at the front of it. So like it can like be pretty distracting if it's like growing pretty like a pretty bright color and it's like you're playing in front of a PC monitor. So you'll see it in your PCs on your PC screen if you're sitting pretty close to it.
Were you able to disable it using like DS4 Windows or something? I believe that has some option for it.
I just decided to do the manual method of just putting duct tape over it. I don't care. Oh, okay. I'm not above that.
We call that an engineering solution.
That's right.
Yes.
But yeah, like when you're playing Pragmata on it, it's a bright white light 24/7, and then like the beginning is like you just see that little blurry white thing on your screen. I'm like, okay, I'm going to
cover it. Change colors during the hacking on the?
I don't think so. I didn't get that far to before I just like covered it up. Hello. Like I just did like within the first 20 minutes of the game. I need to get out of the way. But like aside from like the gameplay and the story that we've mentioned, like I also really like the home base shelter aspect of the game, because as you're progressing through stages, there's like checkpoints that Mikhail alluded to where you can get like a fast travel point back to your home base, and then you can just like fast travel back to that checkpoint when you're ready to set out again. This is where you deal with stuff like upgrades, go to the shop and get like stuff to upgrade your character, whether it's like, hey, I want to have this weapon available to me when I'm about to set out again. You have to like unlock that feature to like equip that gun, because like guns and weaponry in this game are fairly limited, and like they're not persistent in terms of like once you run out of bullets, let's say 4 bullets on like the shotgun equivalent, you kind of just toss it. You don't like reload. You know, there's like no refillable ammo for them. You just find another one in the stage, you get the ammo, or you'll swap it out with your other power weapon.
Yeah, there's, like also, except like, you have like a basic weapon that you have,
yeah, a basic pistol ammo for, yeah. Yeah, but this home base thing is really cool, because this is also where you get a lot of like small time interactions with Diana. So like you can chit chat with her about stuff to kind of learn more about both of these characters, and also throughout the level, sometimes you'll find these things called like REM. I forgot the exact what it stood for.
Read like, Earth Memory.
Yes, thank you. And these are just like real things that you would find in the road, like it's a basketball, a slide, globe, etc. And you can give these to Diana, and like, and that'll like populate your home base when you like kind of recreate these things, and then let that to decorate your home base. And Diana interacts with them, and the kind of paint a picture of like Diana's personality. Like, yes, she's a kid and definitely acts like a kid, but she has. She is an android, a robot, so she has that intelligence and processes like a robot logistically. So like one of the first moments you see with Diana when she's like hacking for the first time, she goes like 10111100, like just speaking binary and like saying that out loud is really funny. But like she does that, you know, that's classic sci-fi trope of like a robot trying to understand human behavior and conditions, why people would engage in such activity. So when you're trying to tell her about, like, you know, why this globe is such a wonderful thing, she kind of ponders about it. It's like, I don't really get it, you know. But as she's messing around with the globe, you know, she's like pointing out stuff like, oh, there's Venezuela, there's Denmark, etc. And just facing things like, there's no, like, it's funny hearing that from, like, you know, someone that looks like a kid, that acts like a kid, but like, you know, in the real world, no kid would ever be able to like distinguish these places when they're looking at a globe for the first time, because they have to, you know, human condition. They're not a robot. They don't know all the locations where they are immediately.
Yeah, I hadn't thought to mention this before, and like obviously won't spoil anything, but mm-hmm. like if people are wondering, like there is a reason why this android is designed as a kid. Like there is a narrative reason for that. It's not just like this random thing.
Mm-hmm. Interested to learn more I'll find that. And also, like, one of the coolest things, and this is alluded to in the demo, the sketchbook demo, like, when you completed that demo, you'd see, like, certain, like, hand-drawn things by Diana when you completed that demo. There's also someone in the marketing as well, but eventually, like, you know, when you're getting these REMs and these, and you do certain things to get these cabin coins, eventually, when you speak enough of Diana and collect those cabin coins, she'll actually show you, like, new hand-drawn artwork that, like, she's illustrated. It does look like, you know, a child drew it. It's like, oh, that's really endearing and really cool that there's, like, multiple of these that you can earn and, like, kind of see. Like, that's how they get
the
reward.
Yeah, you tape them up around the base like you would put them on the fridge if it was your actual kid, you know?
So cool. And you also get, like, a new character in that shelter called Cabin that you unlock early on. And he seems cool, too. I like Cabin a lot.
He's probably, like, the best weird little guy of the year so far. He's basically like a computer tower with legs.
Yeah.
And he just is, like, really
but he's
weird.
For the first time, like, it is that, like, classic, like, you know, old school PC boot up of, like, black screen, white text, like, scrolling down when he's booting up for the first time. I also really dig the sound design of the game, like, the overall OST and, like, the sound design of, like, how certain effects sound, especially with, like, throughout the hacking, and when you're, and also when, like, you go to the title screen for the first time, first before you even get to, like, the main menu, you have, like, this soothing melodic thing that says, hey, press start, and then when you press start to get to the main menu, the title screen, it'll start going to that do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, like, almost like a deep sci-fi pivot to that sound, which is really striking to me.
Yeah, and you mentioned progression. I think, like, the progression is surprisingly good in this game too, and kind of ties into the whole system where it's like you're constantly upgrading things and constantly it really lets you lean into what you want, like,
yeah,
which specific weapons you want to improve, or like I you have three different categories that you can improve of, like, base stats of use health, your weapon damage, and your hacking. And so, like, I completely maximized hacking first before I almost did anything for health and weapons because I thought the hacking was really cool.
Yeah.
It really lets you lean into what you want. I think that's the crux of what I really like about Progmod is how well every little element works together. And it all just feels there's an intentionality to everything. It all kind of, like, clicks together nicely.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that, like it gives you, like, it doesn't really skimp on, like, the upgrade tools. Like, as long as you're willing to explore a little throughout the level, you're constantly getting, like, you know, have enough resources to, like, get new upgrades throughout it. So, unlike you, I invested mostly on, like, the pistol first to maximize damage and, like, and the bullet capacity and all that stuff, and then the hacking next after that. And also, for the other currency, I wanted to get better mobility options, so I invested in thrusters and dash dodge mechanic that feels really good when it's upgraded now. Either way, like you said, it's up to you on what you want to focus on. So I've really found, like, that play style of, like, hey, I'm more mobile during encounters, and I also invested in, like, the shotgun equivalent and, like, the grenade launcher equivalent that makes enemies fall to the ground, and, like, those have been, like, my go-tos for right now, and I wonder if it's gonna I can't wait to see, like, you know, other options later on. It feels nice that, like, I don't have to really feel like the game is, like, very scarce with its resource how often it gives you resources. Like, no, it's fairly generous about it. You explore a little, and so that's why I'm more confident in investing those in things I want to play around with now, rather than, like, saving it up, hoping that, like, I'll find the thing that's to me.
Yep. It's the last thing to mention too is, like, I didn't expect this game to be one that had, like, a pretty robust post game content selection, but it actually does. Like, you finish the main story and you get this whole, like, post game side quest called, like, Mysterious Signal. It gives you like stronger versions of bosses to go back and fight, and then these extra challenge missions with some, like, neat rewards too at the end. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, main story is like 12 to 14 hours ish. You could probably spend another 4 or 5 on post game content too, which was a nice surprise.
Capcom has been really good about that. Like the like same thing with like Resident Evil Requiem. You know, like there was really good incentives to go back and continue playing that game after you finished it once because of the resource shop for modifiers, and there's like trophies you can get to kind of optimize the way that you play through that game with a more upgraded arsenal through that and harder difficulty mode to comp, you know, put you up to that power law, making it so like even though you have like new tools to play around with, like the game is still gonna make ensure that like it's still challenging. Capcom has been really good about, you know, a game after the game's done.
I want to go back to what Hayes started with, both here and in the review, because I just really do appreciate and agree with Hayes on this, that, you know, Capcom has maybe the best, like, wealth of franchise and IP under them that they work with and have, you know, across a variety of genres with, you know, Street Fighter and Monster Hunter and Mega Man and Resident Evil and all this stuff. But they, you know, Pragmata's been in the works for a while, but even with some of the other games that Hayes mentioned, like Exo Primal and Kintsugami, the fact that they still spend time, money, people, effort on like new ideas, not just like IP, but also like mechanically, in terms of like what type of game this is and like new characters, new setting, no established canon or anything like that, just something brand new. You know, I don't know how well Pragmata is going to be do like in terms of sales or whatever, and I don't know what their expectations are, but the fact that they kind of go through all this effort to try something new and inventive, I really appreciate them for that. They're not just stuck in their, like, you know, rut of let's just churn out all of our franchises. And, you know, while Capcom also does, you know, like multimedia approaches to things like Monster Hunter and Resident Evil or whatever, the fact that they're also including in their kind of variety of output something like this, I really do appreciate that.
Yeah, and I think like Pragmata is something that genuinely feels new. Like that hacking shooting combination is genuinely unlike anything else I've played. I think that's really interesting. And like you said, I felt the same way about like Exo Primal, because the way that game did like cooperative PvP shooting was really fascinating. And I appreciate willingness to experiment.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what? I feel like there's something not a lot of people have picked up on. It's like they've taken that Yakuza Club Maharaja minigame and put it into... That's what Pragmata's hacking game is, literally, in the end. And it's fantastic for me, because when I first played Yakuza 0, I had like 40 hours just in that minigame. So like when I saw it in the demo, I was like, wow, someone's finally done something like that again.
Yeah, just to be clear, I'm not trying to say like this has never, ever, ever been done before. It's brand new and whatever, but you know, that's a little bit...
Oh, no, I didn't mean it that way. I meant like, yeah.
I feel like at any time someone says like, wow, this is inventive or new, some, you know, devil's advocate somewhere is going to be like, no, it was done first over here. And it's like, okay, I know it's not literally brand new, like no one's ever even thought of this before, but just the fact that Capcom's taking like, you know, something a little bit different, putting their own twist on it, it's not just a carbon copy of something that's been done before. It's not like Resident Evil, it's not like Monster Hunter, it's, you know, not just a third person shooter. It's just kind of an interesting combination, and that goes for both mechanics, story, characters, settings. It's the fact that they're doing something like this, like I think that's extremely, extremely interesting and cool.
I think it's a really big game design accomplishment and what this game does. Because when you think about it, like when this game was first unveiled 4 to 5 years ago, like this game was in development hell for a while and reemerged. And like thinking about like how many times they had to iterate and reiterate on like on this game in general, because you think about like how it turned out, it's like, man, if you think about like how game development generally works, it's like, I wonder how many times they had to reinvent the wheel in behind the scenes of development to kind of get to where they are now. Because this must have been a nightmare to create.
This is one that, like, when interviews eventually come out 6 months, 12 months down the road on like development process, it's gonna be fascinating to see how it came together and like how many times they rebooted it or whatever it might be, you know?
sometimes with these long and dev games, sometimes you kind of get a feeling where either they at some point just decide, whatever, we got to push it over the finish line. You just have to get it out there, and maybe to its detriment. I'm just speaking kind of vaguely here. But in this case, this game, you know, it was kind of the butt of jokes for a while there in terms of like, oh, Pragmata's delayed again. This game is in hell or whatever. Like, no way this is going to be anything good. Some people might say that. But the fact that
they goes back to deep down now.
Yeah, deep down, that website is still up, or at least it was last time I checked. I don't know if it's ever been officially canceled. We'll just see that, like, it'll just show up at Summer Game Fest or something. I'm joking. But anyways, the fact that Capcom just, you know, took their medicine or whatever analogy you want to use, they put this game, they gave it the time that it needed, and maybe, like Hayes said, maybe we'll learn about some of the things that were, like, in the initial, you know, like, prototype and maybe concepts that they had, but maybe didn't work or had to change. And, like, how did it become the game that it ended up being today? It'll be cool to see.
We just have to hope that also that the developers, like, that Capcom had, like, expectations that are, you know, reasonable and manageable. Because sometimes you see, like, other studios try new IPs, and either they never make it to release because they don't think they're going to get, you know, an unreasonable return on it, usually from, like, some of the bigger Western studios, but, you know, it's all over the place. Or I think of recent stories, and it's not all analogous, but, like, the Kazan team is, as far as I know, more or less disbanded, despite that game having decent, seemingly commercial and critical success. But, like, it maybe didn't set the world on fire, but it was just unfortunate to see, like, oh, I guess that team doesn't get a second crack at it. Like, what a bummer. So I just hope Pragmata doesn't, you know, sell underneath unreasonable expectations, and therefore it's not seen as a success.
Yeah, it would suck if Capcom decided, oh, that wasn't worthwhile, let's never do that again or whatever. Like, you know, it was a mistake to be experimental, because I don't think it is.
I think there's one thing that tells me that Capcom had a bit of confidence in Pragmata more than a few other games that, you know, like Hayes brought up Exoprimal and Kunitsugami. Both games I really like. In fact, Exoprimal, I remember people comparing it to Babylon's Fall, a game which I have the platinum trophy of, which I'll never stop bringing up. But yeah, Exoprimal was pretty amazing in how you had the PvP aspect, and then it ended up being in this massive over-the-top PvE thing, which I had, like, unlike anything I had played before. But then both of those games, Kunitsugami and Exoprimal, were in Game Pass day one. So that tells me that either Microsoft made them a good enough offer, or Capcom wanted to get some financial backing for that. But with Pragmata, they didn't bother doing that. It's just a near full-price game, premium game, no bullshit. No microtransactions or anything. You just buy it, you get the complete thing. Even the deluxe pack, which they're selling, is all just cosmetic nonsense. You don't need it. And it's just one DLC thing. So I think it just shows that they were a bit more confident. Like, they probably, towards the end of development, when they had, like, tests or whatever going on and impressions, signs were pointing to a positive reception. And it's kind of shown, because I don't think anyone dislikes anything about it. Everyone I know who's played it is just, like, enjoying it a lot. And some people have already finished it in, like, 2 days since launch. So, yeah.
It's interesting to look at, like, you know, Pragmata was in development a long time. And we obviously know, like, AAA games have way too long in development cycles. But, like, Capcom has been pretty good in terms of scheduling their releases. Like, this year alone, you have Resident Evil Requiem and Monster Hunter Stories 3, Pragmata, and we still have Onimusha, which is scheduled for later this year.
And there was a Mega Man collection in there also.
Yeah, Mega Man collection too. It's just kind of amazing that we have all of these things within the span of 6 months of each other.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like Capcom and Nintendo are the publishers that I can think of off the top of my head that really keep that good cadence and are very, like, strategic.
I don't know about Nintendo right now. Like, on the Switch 1 era, for sure, I feel like right now it's a bit iffy. Like, they did release Pocopia and Tomodachi Life, but then, like, I don't know. The vibe I'm getting is that people are not happy with the cadence of Switch 2 releases compared to Switch 1. And that's probably, like, unrealistic expectations, because 2017 was, like, a year you're never going to see from Nintendo ever again. They had, like, banger after banger every single month. And now you just have, like, games getting more expensive, and they're padding it with, like, the, you know, like the $10 or $20 upgrades for existing games. So I'd say Nintendo in the Switch One era for sure. Now it remains to be seen.
That's fair.
Yeah. But the cadence of releases is good, because you look at like Square Enix, right? When they had that span of all those new IPs.
Probably the worst example.
Yeah.
But think of if Square Enix had scheduled it better, like something like Harvestella might have been able to get more traction, really become something if it had room to breathe, you know?
Yeah, it's like, in like of all those games that they released in 2022, you can actually look at like the Steam numbers and tell that, oh no, if they'd given it a bit more time to breathe, if they'd given it a bit more marketing, if they'd had it not just be on Switch and PC, so that there could be more organic discussion about the game that wasn't just limited to people that only play on Nintendo consoles and people that only play on PC. That game should have been a much bigger success for them, and it wasn't the game itself that was the limiting factor.
Mm-hmm. And they didn't even release the, like, I'll never let this go, they never released the soundtrack on CD, and they region locked the digital soundtrack. Like, oh, I'll just God, never yeah. let that go. Like, and it's such an amazing soundtrack.
Yeah. I keep remembering that. I hate it so fucking much.
I keep seeing more and more people come around on Harvestella. Like,
I haven't played it yet.
Every month I see someone play it and be like, why didn't anyone tell it? Like, this game's amazing. I wish I'd played it when it came out.
I have two random kind of comments to bring up, well, Square Enix related. One, like, we just passed the 4-year anniversary of Kingdom Hearts 4 announcement.
Oh, man.
Like, it's been 4 years since they announced it. That's obviously like a big budget, you know, pie, whatever, like the biggest project possible that you could get from Square Enix almost. But also, I'm still just kind of dumbfounded, like, Bravely Default came out. It was a Switch 2 exclusive, like the remaster, I mean. Then it just kind of shadow dropped on PC and Xbox, and it's still not on PlayStation. It's just kind of like, this should be like, why is this even like, why is this still a thing? Like, it, that you just have these like staggered release, and even when it does come out for other platforms, yeah. It's like, it's still not available on PlayStation. It's still not available on PlayStation for some reason.
Like, even if like Bravely Default is the exception, the fact that they've said that they were going to stop that shit means that because it keeps happening, nobody's going to believe you.
I don't know.
It reminded me. Someone really put it into perspective, and it made me go, like, it kind of made my eyes wide for like a split second. Since the announcement of Kingdom Hearts 4, Falcom has started the Calvard arc, and almost like what, three games to the Calvard arc within that time frame of it getting announced. I'm like, fuck, that's
also somewhat related. I actually started playing the Tales of Berseria remaster, and like, this is only like two Tales games ago, so it still in a way feels recent, but like, oh yeah, this was 9 years ago when this came out. There's been two Tales games in 9 years. I mean, besides like some mobile entries or whatever, but just like,
Tales almost used to be a almost yearly series.
So like,
almost.
If you're like a teenager now, like, I would not be surprised if there's a bunch of teenage Trails fans, because you get to play a new game every year or whatever, right? Like, where we could, when we were younger, like with Tales or Final Fantasy, like when they had a game like every other year at least, there's been some discussions about, I know we're kind of gone on a different tangent here, but there's been some discussions about like, people don't get as maybe attached to franchises because they take like 6 years for a new entry. So you get like two entries in your childhood and that's it, which is a bit different. But Trails doesn't do that.
When I was doing that piece last year of Super Robot Wars, the chronicling almost like, you know, the original generation series, but like when I started looking at like the cadence, like the release years of like those games, they were new Super Robot Wars games releasing like yearly for two decades up until like the PS3 generation. Every year there was always a new game for that for like 20 to 25 years. Like, what the fuck, man?
It's crazy too, because Tales of Arise was like far and away the most successful Tales game of all time. Like, not even close. You look at like, look at everything Sega's done with Persona since Persona 5 blew up. And, you know, Bandai Namco just kind of dropped the ball in doing anything with Tales after its most successful entry.
Atlas has been doing really funny things with Persona, though, very, very recently with their whole merch drop on very Amazon recently, with 1 and 2.
Well, to kind of just loop this back to the original discussion of Pragmata, I think we heard, you know, Hayes's kind of, well, I'll say full thoughts, but of course the written thoughts as well are on the written review up on the site at rpgsite.net. So go ahead and check that out and give it a read.
I also want to shout out too. I'm playing it on English voiceovers. The English VA is really good, but what really sold me on it when someone pointed it out before release, the voice actor of Malice from Xenoblade voices Hugh in this game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's real. And then, like, once someone pointed that out, I was like, oh fuck, you can hear it. that's pretty good.
Is Diana's voice actress in a Xenoblade game too?
Yeah, I think she's like a Nopon, I believe. One of the Nopon characters is also, yeah, I believe
so. So it's basically just a Xenoblade game.
Yeah.
How is Diana's voice actress? Because young like girls in English are sometimes, depending on the voice actress, I think they can be iffy for me.
She's great. She's pretty good.
She's great. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Nails it.
That's natural. Completely. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Cool. Yeah. It seems like, you know, children characters are hard to nail, you know, in general. So sometimes they turn me off when they're not done well, but when they're done really well, they can be very endearing. So good to hear that it's on that side for this one. And I know she's a robot, but yeah. We also do have Mikhail's, like, he spoke to it here, but his performance comparison for Pragmata is also a feature up on the site. Okay, with that, we have 3 other games listed here that we're going to touch in on before going into, like, articles, features, and news. In no real particular order here. This one I just kind of threw in here because I figure this week is a good week to talk about it. Why not? And Adam can speak to this a little bit because he's been watching me play it. Over the last week, I had finished up. I still can't play Starfield because my progression is still soft locked. Before we started recording, I'm like, they still haven't patched it, and I'm not going to console, you know, trickery around it. So I'm just gonna put that down until they fix it, if they ever fix it. I played the Metroid games, Dread and Beyond, just to catch up on those. And then I was like, what should I play next? Is there anything productive I can play in terms of the podcast, in terms of the site? And this summer in Adam, right, June, I believe the Gothic 1 remake is slated to come out, and I am currently slated to review it, but I'd never played the original, so I decided to play the original Gothic. 2001 RPG from Piranha Bytes, PC only at the time, though. We'll talk about that a little. It's on Switch now, and we'll talk about some other console ports.
Yeah, let me just interrupt real quick. Like, Gothic is one of those games that, like, you hear, especially from, like, European developers, a lot of people making games now, they're calling it, like, this is Gothic inspired or a Gothic like, or, you know, my favorite RPG when I was growing up was Gothic. And, like, it's a really beloved kind of, like, European RPG. And I was, like, vaguely familiar with, like, okay, I've seen some videos, I know a little bit about it, but I've never played it myself either. So, like, this is definitely something, like, maybe academically, but also just because it seems enjoyable for a game from that era. Like, something that I think is just worthwhile to actually, like, been watching Brian play through it. Like, there are a lot of things inspired by this game to kind of go back to the source. I think that's kind of a cool little, like, you know, project to go through to just play it.
And shout out to the GOG preservation program, because I bought it on Steam. I tried to play it and it would not load. Apparently, there's certain Steam Workshop things that if you click the right buttons in the right order, you can make it work. But I was just like, I wonder if the GOG version works out of the box. And it does. So good shout out to GOG. It has, like, all, like, the because this has, like, a, this game has, like, a fan following for the last 25 years. It came out in 2001. So it has, like, custom patchers and, you know, allows the game to work in a 64-bit environment with more than, you know, a gig of RAM, things like that. So it works out of the box on GOG. Good shout out to them. So that's where I've been.
GOG succeeding in their mission statement. Just you buy it and it works.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And there's other things you can do. Like, there's tons of mods available, but I'm just basically playing it out of the box with, like, mods that are just to help it run, basically. Allow it to alt tab and work in a window. So is Gothic, I'm about 20 hours in, I'm in, like, chapter 4 of 6, so I haven't completed it, but I've played enough to, like, really get a feel for it, I think. And is Gothic a good game? Like, is this a game that I'd say, like, yes, RPG fans should play this? It's one of those things that's a difficult question to answer without, like, couching it in a lot of caveats. I really don't think it is, but not in, like, a way that I'm disappointed. But I think it really is just kind of an age thing where a lot of things, it feels kind of like a prototype of a game, a very inventive prototype, a prototype that I can see why it's been listed as kind of like the go-to, like, we're going to compare our game to Gothic because why not, or Morrowind or whatever like that. So to tee it up just very quickly, the game takes place in basically a penal colony, a slave colony. There's a kingdom that you are given a very, very basic, very high level, very pixelated, like, intro cinematic for, that's at war. And as part of the war effort, they need to mine this magic ore to use in their weaponry. Like, ore is literally like the currency of the game. So anyone who has been convicted of, like, a crime gets thrown into this penal colony, which is basically a bunch of outcasts inside like a magic dome, like a barrier that they cannot escape. There are multiple camps in this place. Everyone here is a former, you know, criminal or slave, or I guess former criminal, current slave. And then your character, who's like a nameless hero, is thrown in, and you're basically like presumed innocent, but you're stuck here anyway. They don't care that you're innocent. Like, you're here, so you might as well be, you know, you might as well be here. The game is set up very gamey, if that makes sense. Like, it doesn't really shoot for realism. There are three camps, and you are basically directed to pick one of them. And the camps are very, like, very straightforwardly named. There's the old camp, there's the new camp, and then there's the sect camp, S-E-C-T. And those are like the people that are more like spiritual or magical. And you have to choose them. And all these camps are full of like bad people. There's no like protagonist or antagonist among them. Like they're all very hierarchical. They're all very like almost fascist. Like they're not good people. They really like their stratified societies. They really value, you know, strength and ability. Also, basically every character in this game is an adult man, an adult white man. There are no people of color. There are no children. And any women in the game are shown as either like, you know, slaves or concubines, basically, or like prostitutes. So on that front, very much a
early 2000s product of its time,
and I'm not saying that as an excuse. It's really quite sad. It's definitely a pretty big blemish on the game. I haven't gotten to the very end, so maybe I'll be surprised. But it's something I hope the remake can do better. That's something they can for sure tweak from, I think. But
yeah, so, definitely an area of improvement, like an avenue for improvement.
Yeah, so the game has a very open-ended structure in terms of like UI, in terms of progression. Like, you do have like a character screen, but your stats are pretty basic. You have like strength, which is how you use weapons, like martial weapons. You have dexterity, which is how you use bows or crossbows, and then you have mana, which you use for spells. And a lot of this, surprise, I've played Elex, which is one of Piranha Bytes last games before they unfortunately went under in 2025, which also draws heavily from Gothic, which was their first game. In terms of in Elex, there were like the barbarian group, and there were like the technical group and things like that. In Gothic, it's all more of a medieval fantasy, so there's a little bit less, it's all low tech. The old camp is basically like the Brotherhood of Steel. The new camp is more, I guess, kind of more like the Enclave, to use some points of comparison. They're both basically very like power or war-driven societies in their own ways. And then the sect camp is like they end up being like a driving force for the story, because this is going to sound really dumb, and I don't know how to explain it in a way that doesn't make it sound asinine or very silly. But there's like herbs in this game that they smoke, and then whenever they smoke it, they go and see visions from what they believe is their god called the Sleeper. And this ends up being like a central figure of the game, is who is the Sleeper? What is he driving them to do? And also, everyone wants to try to get out of this barrier erected by the kingdom, this barrier that keeps them like shackled to this colony. And when I played Drova, I didn't realize that in Drova, it's a very similar setup where there's basically like a magic dome that you can't escape it, because if you do, you'll instantly die. And it's like, oh, that literally is lifted straight from Gothic, not even like reinterpreted. That's basically one for one kind of what it is. If you go to the edge of the map, a lightning bolt hits you and you're dead. Like, that's basically what it is. The gameplay is very rudimentary. This is not a game you play for engaging gameplay. It's an action RPG, which kind of surprised me. I thought it'd be more like turn-based or at least real-time with pause, but it's completely real-time. If you wield your weapon, and then you hold the control button, because it does have controller support now because of the Switch version and things like that, but I'm playing it on the PC where it's not Gothic 1 Classic, it's Gothic 1, and it doesn't have the controller support baked in natively. I'm sure you can make it work, but I'm with a keyboard. And as you hold control, you basically stance up with your weapon, and pressing W, A, S, and D. Pressing W makes you swing it forward. Pressing A makes you swing it left. Pressing S makes you like block, and pressing D makes you swing it right. And there's a few other things you can do, but it's very clunky. It's not good. I'm sure it was fine at the time, and it's fine now. Like, it's workable, but it's not good. It's definitely another product of its time. So I tried to answer the question as I played this, like, why was this so inspiring to a lot of people? Like, what is there about this game to take away from it? And I think there's kind of two things. One, the world space is actually pretty small. This is not a game that focuses on quantity of like destinations or tasks or quests. It's maybe the anti Crimson Desert. I don't know. I haven't played Crimson Desert, so maybe that's not fair. But what happened?
I heard that's
is,
what Pragmata was, the anti Crimson Desert. Someone said that genuinely. I'm joking. I mean, I'm
well,
not
let
joking.
Me actually put
whoever some... made that thumbnail wasn't joking, I don't think.
Well, let me actually put some meat behind that, so it's not just a dumb statement. What I mean by that is that the world space is pretty small. Like, in this game is divided into chapters, and in chapter one, you will explore 80 to 90% of the world space. Like, the main camp's in the center. There's a camp on the left of the screen. There's a camp on the right of the map. There's like the orcs, which are to the I believe the south, and then there's like goblins to the. And I might be getting some of the directions wrong, but what happens is as you progress through the quests, the world space changes. At first, slightly, and then less slightly. I wouldn't say majorly. I think they were like technically limited at the time. And you could argue that they were just trying to preserve the world space because of resource management. They don't have to create many multiple environments. They have a cast of NPCs, probably like 40 named characters in total, about 15 of them being really important. And they can, they each have quests for you. In each chapter, they can move them around. So you'll be like, oh, it's Lester. I first met him at the sect camp, but now he's helping me at the tower fort, sort of thing. And he's got a new quest for me this chapter. And there's a little bit of persistence from chapter to chapter, of course, like which camp you join and things like that. So I kind of like the idea of a game that reuses its world space like that and uses story progression to mock the progression of time. And then if a developer is clever enough to really have some persistence based on like your choices or the outcomes of events or things like that. I think that is an idea or an archetype that I think could be forever enduring or implemented in many different ways. So that's one thing I look at Gothic, like
instead of some game worlds where you kind of like visit an area, then you like complete it, check it off the list, and then you move to the next one. This game's not built.
Dragon
like
Age
that.
Origin, yeah. Or sorry, I guess Dragon Age, but like Dragon Age, or even like Xenoblade 1, where you just kind of go from region to region, and of course that's fine too. Like, there's nothing wrong with that style, but I think Gothic style is a certain style that maybe Western RPGs have kind of gotten away from. It's been more like, let's just make the map bigger and put more stuff in it, and make the map even bigger and put more stuff in it, and just say no, just try making the map smaller and then put more stuff in it, and you'll have to do that slightly differently, but I think it can create a different style or different feeling of game. Certain areas where Gothic comes up short is that even though you pick a camp at the beginning, apparently after, and I realized this because I played chapters 2, 3, and 4, even though like at the beginning it's like you got to pick a camp and you can't go back on your choice, after you do, the story pretty much is the same regardless of who you picked. And that could just be a limitation at the time. It was the first game. I don't know if it's realized better in the sequels or anything like that. So that's something where I think if you were to make the game, quote unquote, bigger, that's something you could do, is just make that initial faction choice more meaningful. Like, don't be afraid to lock the player out of, you chose this group, therefore you can't do this quest line, or you chose this group, therefore these people will always be hostile to you. Like, I think more games should be not afraid to, like, inconvenience the player in small ways, as long as the game is scoped so that you know it's not 100 hours, and then you can replay it, and then you can pick the other option to see what you missed, or, you know, whatever. Give some meaning to that. I also do think that it's just kind of a clever tool set in terms of, like, what you're allowed to do. Like, for instance, there was one part of the, as a true RPG in terms of, like, having choice or consequence, not in terms of, like, either be violent or be peaceful. Like, that's kind of like the most binary way to do it. But there's one part where I had to get a crystal that was up on a high ledge that I couldn't reach. And the two ways that I found you could get it are either you help a guy out, You give him, like, a deed to an abandoned fort so that he can, like, make it his home, and then he teaches you telekinesis, and then you can use that on the crystal to levitate it towards you. Or you can just put points into acrobatics and then drink a speed potion and then just jump really far, and then you can get there anyway without using telekinesis. And the quest doesn't tell you to do either of those things. The quest log is a little bit more minimal. There's no waypointing. There's no... The maps that you get are diegetic. Like, you can't pull up a map unless you buy a map. And then when you pull it up, your character has to actually take it out of their inventory and look at it. It's not just a UI element. It's a game element, if that makes sense. And then, like, if you're doing a quest where someone has to mark on your map where to find something, they'll say, like, hey, I'll give you another map. So you have to go to your inventory and select that map to actually see what they gave you. So I like the little bit of, like, lived in feeling of that. So basically, now that Gothic, I'm probably going to finish it this weekend. Now with that behind me, I'll have a little bit more of a framework to understand. Like, I know when the remake back in, like, 2019, wasn't it? Like, it was like 5 years ago, 6 years ago at this point when it first did its, like, initial playable test.
Yeah, I know people didn't like the initial demo. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure why. Because I didn't have the context.
So I'm basically... I would have hated, the whole reason I'm doing this is I would have hated to go into Gothic Remake and been like, I don't know what this game's like. I don't know why people are comparing it. Like, basically, I didn't want to come from a place of ignorance. So now, hopefully, I can say, like, oh, they did this different and it's better. They did this different and it's worse. Oh, they kept the spirit of the game here. Oh, they lost the spirit of the game here. And we'll see.
It is probably also worth mentioning that you're playing just Gothic as it was on PC, right? I mean, packaged up by GOG, right? But THQ Nordic actually has, even just as of this week, been, like, porting those games, like the Gothic Classic Collection, to, like Switch and PS5 and a few other things.
Let's touch on that just so we don't have to revisit it, like, later in an awkward manner, because I think we can touch this real quick. So Gothic 1 and 2, and Mikhail, interrupt me if I get this wrong, Gothic 1 and 2 are already available on Switch 1. Like, over the last couple years, they've released. They've announced that Gothic Classic, Gothic 2 Classic, Gothic 3 Classic, the Classic is the tagline that they're giving to the console versions, are releasing for PlayStation 4 and 5 and Xbox. Gothic 1 is coming to those platforms in July, Gothic 2 in September, and Gothic 3 in November. They've also confirmed that Gothic 3 is coming to Switch 2. It's not, like, as far as I can tell, completely confirmed that it's going to come to Switch 2 at the same time as the other platforms, but I think it's a decently safe guess, at least the same time window. So by the end of the year, all three games will be available on consoles. Go ahead, Mikhail.
I think what happened is, when they had their THQ showcase a few months ago, that's when they announced that they're bringing the three games to PlayStation and Xbox, but they didn't say anything about Switch 2 or Switch 1 at that time. There was speculation that Gothic 3 would be coming to Switch 1. What's happened since then is when they announced the dates for the PlayStation versions, they didn't confirm retail releases or anything. They just announced the dates and the price, and retailers put up listings based on the distribution channels. Like THQ Nordic's, Plyon and Koch Media, like, they're all counted as the same thing. Their distribution network is massive, so retailers put up listings whenever games get announced. And when the trilogy went up, VGP, which is a retailer in Canada, an online one, they put up a listing for even Gothic 3 on Switch 2. And at that point, this was not announced by THQ or by anyone, basically. And I think what happened is this, like, prompted them to confirm that, yes, it is coming to Switch 2, but they didn't give a date or anything or a price. So they just wanted to get ahead of the leak if they could in some way with the marketing. So that's, they did not announce any date or anything. It's just like coming to Switch 2, and no information on whether Gothic 1 and 2 are getting Switch 2 enhancements or anything. So it's kind of a bizarre thing. Like, I haven't played Gothic 3. My only experience with the franchise is literally Gothic 1 Classic and Gothic 2 Classic on Switch when I was just like testing backward compatibility stuff. I have the games on Steam, but I believe they don't have controller support or something like that, so I just never bothered doing it. But when you spoke about the GOG version, I think I'm going to like give that a look to see, because GOG is usually good about adding controller support to games that don't have them as well. So I just, like, it's a little annoying that this seemingly is going to be the same as when, like, not an RPG, but when the Stalker trilogy came to consoles. The PC versions never got controller support or any of the modern features until, like, much, much later. So we don't know if Gothic Classic is going to come to PC in any way, but it would be good to have controller support for the classic games on PC for those who don't want to play the remake. Because the remake, I believe, is going to be, like, way more demanding. So there's a good chance it won't even run for a lot of people if it's an Unreal Engine 5. So, yeah, that's like it's a confusing rollout, I'd say. Like, they should just confirm it's coming to everything at the same time.
Yeah, and it's just too bad that, you know, THQ owns the IP now and Piranha Bytes is dead. Like, it's just like, oh.
Yeah, it's kind of like two sides of a coin here. Like, one, I'm glad that they are taking, you know, an early 2000s RPG that, as you said, is kind of is dated in a few ways, but making it available that you can buy it, like, on a modern console. Like, it's available. Not every game gets that luxury. So I applaud them for that. But on the other hand, it's like, yeah, the team Piranha Bytes was closed. Like, they no longer exist. So it's out of their hands. It's kind of, yeah, it's kind of sad.
And I've heard that Gothic 2 is by far the high watermark. I've heard, like, everything since then was, like, trying to recapture that magic and never succeeded. So I'm excited to see if Gothic 1 Remake succeeds, if they continue. And then apparently Gothic 2 has, like, a really popular total conversion mod called Archolos, Archolos, that is, like, overwhelmingly positive, 3,000 reviews on Steam, like, released 6 years ago. So, like, I don't know if I'm going to replay the whole Piranha Bytes, you know, catalog, but something I'm keeping in the back of my mind, that, like, these games have been followed for so many years by so many passionate fans, that there's, like, a whole modding society out there for, like, total conversions and updates and added stuff and all that stuff. So yeah. The next game we have listed here, which is a pretty big departure, is a game that I think Adam was talking about on the podcast. I forget if that was a podcast or about or just another Discord call that wasn't being recorded. But the game is Mongol Star Dive, which Adam, you were talking to the developer about it.
Yeah,
right?
I had an interview at GDC. Yeah, with Netmarble.
That's what it was. Yeah, and then so you covered the details there with the interview with the executive there. But this week, Josh has done the
Josh thing.
The responsibility of getting in there and playing some Mongol Star Dive. So the hands-on feedback for this game.
Full release for it. Because I'm a totally broken person. I usually like to dig in and if a new free-to-play game is coming out, I'll give it a whirl and see what it's about. So Mongol Star Dive is, like, a game I don't know if I was really that interested in, but it's a nice departure in the sense that, like, I treat it like a single player RPG, just like in terms of, like, I'm not spending anything on it. It's a fairly linear game in terms of, like, just progressing through it. It's not open world. It's very reminiscent of, like, you know, PS2 era RPGs, where it's like there's zones that are all fairly limited. The map design is, you know, it's fairly straightforward. Some, you know, some dead ends in the path for, like, treasure chests and sometimes the occasional puzzle or what. But I guess for people who don't know, Mongol Star Dive is a new free-to-play RPG with a gacha system from Netmarble. People in that space who hear Netmarble and hear should probably hear like red flags in their head. Because Netmarble is a fairly let's say they don't have the greatest reputation in this space because they are known for pretty heavy monetization and very sparse freebies to incentivize its player base to spend the games that they release tend to have a very grindy progression in terms of like how you're building up your characters throughout it. So in this game, you know, it's kind of like a comedic RPG in the sense that like you have these two main characters, and I swear to God, the main dude's character's name is Cloud, and then the main female's name is Verna. These are the first two characters you meet in the game, and they're sort of like they're kind of both generic characters in the sense, like, yeah, they go around and kind of help other people when they can, but it's like the main character focus kind of switches in between each story chapter in the game, like story episodes. So, like, I think like in episode 2, like the main character in that is I think it's Esther. Esther is the one for episode 2, and she's like the banner featured character. She's like a former commander who now works as a maid, but she has a quick draw samurai style with her broom in it, and so she has this whole, you know, conflict within her village that they need to go take care of. And the overall story premise is like there's like these ominous dark seeds that are corrupting creatures and people throughout the land. So you, as Cloud and Verna, are like kind of going from locale to locale trying to figure out the source of this like whole corruption. And you know, obviously there was like a secret antagonistic faction behind it.
So where does the Black Hole Cat come into play?
The black hole cat is at the very beginning of the game. You meet this Black Hole Cat after rescuing Cloud from almost getting cooked, like literally cooked in a pot. And so you don't know the origins of this Black Hole Cat. Like, its default name is Neaners. You can rename it to whatever you want. And this Black Hole Cat is what it does is like it's a special creature that can suck up creatures and poop them out as monsterlings. So like they suck up the creature and then they come out of its butt like almost like a gachapon little pull pellet. And you can like equip those as like accessories to your character. To that. So that's what Nyaners allows you to do. And like the whole cutscene direction in it is very much like almost a Saturday morning cartoon where like body animations and expressions are like they're more animated than what you would see in other games within this space. It's very expressive, like how characters move in cutscenes. It's not always like that, but for some main story cutscenes it's like that. There's definitely parts of like the overall package where it's definitely not up to that quality. Like for example, the limited time launch event that focuses on Esther because she's the main banner character. She's like she has event story episodes that are basically just like unvoiced character interactions of like just two models like emoting to each other and without any voices, and it's very cheap in comparison to that more expressive, obviously more expensive presentation of storytelling in that regard. But I've just been treating it as like it's a very mindless game to play. That's like it's easy to just kind of pour some, you know, 45 minutes to an hour into it to do some progression. It's very by the books. Hey, you can go progress some main story quests. There are some side quests that are easily marked. Like everything around like this game, it's like very
So when I was speaking to the director, like I don't have a whole lot of context for this, so maybe you can add some insight. He said that this game is meant to be more like casual compared to contemporaries. Do you think that's the case?
I think in terms of like just the general tone of it is more casual. It doesn't. What I like about it in terms of like when it's presenting its story and characters, it's not filled with like a lot of like heavy terminology that like a lot of like other free to play games like to do, like because they have their own world building and whole settings, so you have to establish, oh, what does, you know, Biblu mean in this world, and we have like the hypervisor extraordinaire, what the hell does that, what is that, you know, and just some other games will have like random terminology for them and that like ingrained into the world setting. While this, it's like we're just kind of, we have very generic fantasy settings on orc is an orc, a goblin is a goblin, and then eventually like in chapter 4, like you get to like the more Asian inspired like land, you have yokai there, and it's in terms of like just general tone and general presentation, it's like it, I guess casual is like it's not like you're dealing with some ancient evil and you're the chosen one. It's definitely not that. It's like these characters are going around and in a very carefree, less serious tone, just helping people out and having some funny moments along the way. Like there's like this nurse that you meet that like likes to spread, like, you know, to like stun her enemies. She like spreads like an aroma around to kind of.
When he said casual, I was thinking more like maybe kind of like cynically mindless, you know, just, you know, it doesn't require a lot of thought into how you in playing it or character building or like, I know some of these, I see some people playing like Honkai Star Rail or Genshin or whatever, and they're like getting really deep into, you know, party building and character, you know, like party composition and things like that, you know, really deep into the mechanics and the nuts and bolts of things. Can you do that here?
Yeah, you definitely can, because, well, yeah, yes, you can, but right now, since the launch roster is fairly limited, like, there's only, you know, a certain few teams that you can really make, but, so, in terms of, like, combat mechanics, you have a party of up to three characters, and how combat basically works, it's all in real time, and it's very character-switching focused, where you have a basic attack string for a character, and you have a special skill that like after you use them it goes on a cooldown, and you have an ultimate skill that charges up, and then when you switch them out a character will come in with like their switch in attack, and you can have the same options. When that previous character is exiting that you switched out of, they'll remain on the field for like a few seconds to kind of do their own like exit attack string and then swap out. And it's not necessarily mindless, but it, because each character does have different mechanics working for them. For example, my team right now is Flare, is this twin-tailed redhead tsundere archetype that has like a fire staff that spews out fireballs. Her special skill summons a dragon that does like a flame breath, and her ultimate skill is summons like another dragon that like flies in like for a few seconds and like kind of rams into the enemy and stuff like that. She's really good at building up like this stagger bar in it, so you kind of fire off her skills, switch her out, and let's say my next character is like almost like a bard, or she has like a guitar.
It's like a Korean instrument. They said it in my interview. I forget what they called it.
Yeah, Jin Won, I believe, is her name, and she comes in while Flare is kind of doing some attacks. She can attack at range with her instrument, and then her mechanic is like she's building up like passive like music notes through her basic attack strings, and she can fire off like a few skills to do damage. But her main thing is a support, so when you switch her out with like a full musical note, she'll provide actual like buffs for the next character, especially if they're like a wind character. So let's say my third character is Esther, and she's like that feature limited character that has like is a DPS focus. She gets the buffs from Jinwon, and her thing is that her basic attack string isn't that great. It's kind of clumsy, but it has a nice ender of like that quick draw style. But she has access to a better basic attack string when she uses her special skill first, which is like a AoE around her that confuses enemies within that field as well. And as long as she's in that field, she can do like this up enhanced basic attack strength, like a lot of quick draws. Super powerful, can attack in range too on that. And so you have this cycle of like of these characters switching in and out in tandem. And then with Flare, the first character, the fire character chain, really building up that stagger bar a lot. So when that stagger bar is filled up, you can call in Nyanners, that black hole cat, to kind of incapacitate the enemy. So you like kind of bind them up for a few seconds, and all your characters are out on the field after they're binded up and attacking constantly. So you have you're dishing out like a lot of DPS during that time frame in that whole thing. So in terms of like what you're doing, like the basic flow of combat is very it's very mindless in terms of like once you have your attack rotation down, you don't really have to think about what you're doing. The only thing you have to really look out for is like there are some attacks that have a orange indicator on them, and that means hey, press the dodge button to do like a dodge counter. So once you do that, you'll kind of dodge up to them and hit them in the counter, and that'll stagger them and interrupt them. There are some attacks that are red marked. That means you really have to like you have to manually get out of the way for them with that dodge. You do have like stamina, but it's only used for the dodge as well. And it kind of just all flows together. And of course, I just gave one example of one team. You know, other teams have different characters with their own different mechanics that have like the same flow of like, hey, one character is a damage dealer, one is really good at building up stagger bar, one character is really good at like, you know, providing support for the team. And each character has like a class, like assassins, destroyers, fighters, and support. So assassins are really good during that burst window DPS. Destroyers are really good for the stagger bar. And there's all different elements to them as well that don't really come into play until like more mid to end gamey bosses that have elemental weaknesses. Because in those modes, it's like you're at the timer, you have to beat the boss before the timer ends. So you do increased damage with that elemental when hitting them with an elemental weakness. So you're not as time constrained. And also the weird part about these bosses is there are times when they're like charging up an attack, and like, you know, like during boss fights in other action games, you have to like hit the boss so many times to interrupt them from doing this attack. In this game, you do have that, but for those bosses, you can only hit them with their elemental weakness decrease that gauge. So like, say there's like this enemy that has like a wind weakness and is about to like fire off an attack in this mode. If you have a team that has no wind characters, there's no way at all to interrupt that attack. It's still beatable, but you're gonna have to eat whatever mechanic that is, because you didn't bring a character that corresponds to that wind weakness and so forth. So I don't know exactly what they meant, like casual, but in terms of like mechanical complexity to the combat, I would say I like how responsive and reactive it is, but when I say it's like the most complex, not really. No, but it does look flashy. It has a nice flow to it. It's enjoyable. And then the whole thing with this game is like, there's a random chance that the monsters that you beat on the field will leave like a hologram of them, which are like kind of shows that you can capture them. And it's not like Pokemon where you throw out a Pokeball and like there's a chance for them to not get captured. It's just like it's more on the hey, when you're beating up these mobs and there's like a 25% above their head, it just means there's a 25% chance that they'll leave their hologram on there, and then you just have to press X on them, and it'll suck up any and all monsters who left their holograms up, and you technically collected them. And there's this whole monsterling mechanic where you can combine monsterlings and get stat buffs from them to equip onto your character, like accessories. There's like this link chain system where some special monsterlings, you can actually summon them on the field by doing certain actions. So like, say I get the link chain for this like pufferfish monster, like whenever I activate a skill, it can show up and like do its attack and provide additional damage as well. But you're not actively like summoning them; they just kind of happen on their own as you're doing a fight and stuff.
Are you using any of the male characters?
I am
the rare.
Specimens. I did re-roll a few times because I'm broken like this, but eventually, like after my fourth re-roll, I got two SSR characters on my beginning rolls. It was like one lightning arrow chick and one and then Ophelia, which is like the ice swordswoman. So those are my starting two SSR. And then how the gacha system works is kind of weird because you have like these 20 beginning rolls at a discount, and it's kind of your standard like hit. That's like it's very like, you know, beginner friendly. Like you can get an SSR character very fast from the game gives you in your mailbox when you log in for the first time. You boot it up for the first time, you'll get like these 20 rolls. You spend them on this beginner banner, and you'll get a random 5-star standard character after 20 rolls. So it's like, hey, they're giving you basically a 5-star for free. You can also get a 5-star character like within those 20 beginning rolls as well. That won't reset that, you know, thing. So I got two SSR characters out of that. Then after that, you have another standard banner that opens up where you can get an SSR of your choice. You select the character that you want, and then it's guaranteed to you within 50 rolls. So you can just like play the game, earn those rolls, because a lot of things you do in this game, you'll gain currency for rolling and stuff like that. So at first, I wanted like the character with the instrument, the support character. So, but I got her early. So that didn't reset the guaranteed 50. So I got her early, like within the first 20 rolls of that banner. So I switched up that selectable character to Flare, which is like the destroyer character. So I got her within that 50. And then the banner character Esther, I kind of had to like roll like 60 times. But this was all within playing. I didn't spend a cent, but once again, there's like me being really lucky with it too. So there's not like a thumbs up for this game. It's like it's the nature of the beast within these games. Like I said, I'm just treating it like a normal single player RPG where it's like it's a fairly, you know, easy game to progress. Everything is marked out like in terms of like where side quest NPCs are, and if you need to know where to go, you can just press like the L3 on a controller and it'll show you exactly the path you need to go to get to where it is, whether it's like gathering a component or where an enemy mob is. And the game has like a very versatile fast travel system with warp points as you're progressing. So like you never have to walk too far to get to where you need to go. It's like, hey, you need to beat up this mob. Do you want to go here? Yeah, let's fast travel there. So you fast travel to like a warp point that's like maybe like 5 steps out of like out of its range to start that fight and beat it up. And it's just a very, it's a very comfort food RPG to progress in. It's not, it's like, this all within the normal progression of the game. You can, you know, as you progress through the game, you will very much see like where this game really gets grindy later on, and whether you want to stick with it or not. To through that grind is obviously up to players, because you're gonna have to start, you know, eventually that story will run out and you start getting to end game, and it's like, okay, here's end game. You have to optimize your characters. What do I need to do? I need to gather these materials to upgrade my characters, but there's a stamina system to do those upgrade stages, and they only hand out so much stamina within a certain time frame. You know, they front load you with a lot of stamina early on, but then once that's expended, you are either, you know, you have to consume resources to fill up that stamina. And whether you want to do that or not, or just wait it out, is up to you. It's, you know, like I said, it's net marble, so it's going to be pretty stingy up front. Like, I don't wonder how stingy they're going to be as time goes on. Obviously, within the honeymoon phase, they're going to shower people with, like, you know, oh, we have to do maintenance here. Oh, sorry, we did maintenance. Here's, like, a certain amount of currency that you can use to roll. Or here's our launch celebrations. Here's, like, a free 10 roll. You know, and then, you know, once that's dried up, then... And, of course, you know, this game has a lot of, like, microtransactions, shops, like, you know, tabs of shops that, like, hey, if you want to do this, you have to use real money for it. There's like a VIP system in terms of, like, if you want access to this shop, you have to pay us, like, this VIP pass to get access to this shop that has, like, goodies. So, like, there's a whole shop that's, like, you know, paywalled in there. There's a battle pass in there. And then there's like the monthly sub, like all the other games do. And then you have like the FOMO. Hey, for 48 hours only, you got lucky and rolled the banner featured limited banner character. Okay, if you pay us $40 and then in the next 48 hours, you can get like more rolls and other upgrade currency to get a head start on upgrading this character early, and all that sort of shit. On top of, like,
when I interviewed the director, really the CEO of the company, even without me really, like, insinuating it, he promised me, this is not gambling. Do you agree?
All of these games are gambling. Of course all these games are gambling.
I just thought that was kind of funny. Like, I was just sort of asking, you know, like, how does this game work in terms of banners and gacha? He's like, it's not gambling. Like, I didn't say that, but...
Yeah, I mean, it does have that. Like, in terms of, like, the one thing this and the upcoming Neverness to Everness game are trying to do is get away from that 50-50 thing, like in other Hoyo games and in Wuthering Waves. When you are rolling on a featured limited character, there's this thing called the 50-50 in those games, where if you hit a 5-star, there's a 50% chance when you first get that 5-star in that banner, whether it's going to be that featured limited character or someone else that you didn't want from that character. That's what's called the 50-50. And they all deal with it differently on, like, how the banner switches up, like, whether they carry over that 50-50 progress. It's just, like, if you miss that 50-50 the first time, if you get another SSR, again, it's guaranteed to be that featured limited character. So that's why when people say, I lost the 50-50, that means their first 5-star from that banner, they didn't get the character that was featured. So in Mongil and Neverness to Everness, they're getting rid of the 50-50, and their featured limited banner characters, whenever you roll a 5-star on them, it's always going to be guaranteed to be that character. And so it gets rid of the 50-50 altogether, which is nice on paper, and, like, don't get me wrong, that's preferable. But there's always that lingering sense that they're like, okay, what's the catch? What are you doing to, like, offset this? And people are saying maybe they're going to skip on, like, the pool economy that they're giving to players for free as a consequence of, like, no longer having that 50-50, because it's now more easily obtainable to get that featured character in lesser roles, because people won't be able to lose the 50-50 anymore and maybe feel, you know, the urge to spend to get more currency and roll more immediately. In that regard, yeah, it's like, but in terms of, like, just like I said, Mongil Star is a perfectly fine game. It's average. I don't really have any strong dislikes. I don't have any strong likes about the game. I think it's a very comfort food RPG. I would, like, as always in these games, I always tell people, hey, treat it like as a normal game. Don't spend money on it. It's free to try. They're definitely trying to incentivize you to spend money, of course, but just if you still feel strongly about it, like, say after a month and a half to 2 months out, and you want to, you know, justify it to, like, support the developers for paying them back for, like, the fun that you got out of a game, you know, they're perfectly fine. But don't go into the mentality of, like, to spend, like, hundreds immediately. Nah, man. Just take it easy, you know? So it's a totally serviceable.
It's no Star Savior.
It's no Star Savior. I'm still playing. and I guess I'll try Neverness to Everness when that comes. I think I have higher hopes for Neverness to Everness with the Mongil, but that's because like I just didn't really have any. I wasn't even planning to try out Mongil until like I kind of looked into it further. I think the large appeal of the game for me is that at the very least, it's not a big open world like all the other games that are coming out now these days. This is just very straightforward linear zones. It's very fast to travel, to travel throughout that. You don't have to like explore this big open world to get to where you want.
Did you see the thing I pinged you about for Neverness to Everness?
Oh yeah, they had like some collaborations, like some music collaborations and stuff, and like a
Porsche. Yeah, I don't know. They just posted that as like Persona 5 music, and there's a Porsche car or whatever.
Yeah, like, okay. Yeah. So it's funny that's happening, and like Wuthering Waves is also doing a lot of collaborations with like music as well stuff. So, well, that's the in thing now, I guess. There's also two funny changes as well. First. Funny, there's like an emergency maintenance very shortly after Mongil came out, and part of that maintenance was to adjust the animations of a characters in a cutscene because we've definitely talked about it on this podcast, but are you guys familiar with that gesture with like the pinched fingers?
And yeah, how, and it's yes. Koreans are paranoid yes. on this, or seems to give it that seems to be the case, yeah.
So yeah, there's these characters like that, like mingled, like you know, in a cutscene. I didn't think much about it until like someone freeze framed it, and like you know, it would be natural for them to have their fingers in this position, like you know, like they're like kind of mingling each other. But of course, certain players in that I assume target player base because that Marvel is based in Korea, I believe. You know, they had issues with that, so they had to issue an emergency maintenance to fix that up. Had to give compensation for that immediately because you know these characters doing the I guess by happenstance their hand gestures were resembled the pinched fingers emote so that was silly but that's just what it is now I guess within this sphere and the second thing is as you're playing the game, there's this really obnoxious thing that always reminds you that you're playing a live service game, where at the top right corner, you have like, you know, like when you go to like the home screen of like any of these games, you'll have like a banner tab that shows like, you know, here's the featured banner, here's like the featured, it's like basically like rectangular banner tabs that like that scroll across that shows like, here's what's happening, here's the featured banner and whatnot. They had, as you're running around in this game, you always have that banner thing always at the top right corner when you're just like normally playing outside of like combat when you're just like running around from place to place always remind you that like hey there's like it's like first it's like guide and then the other one's like here's the current ongoing event that's going on just it's annoying but especially because like the logos for these things was filling out that whole rectangular thing and one of them was like bright green so it's like okay it's a little annoying. So one of the somewhat early fixes to that was to not get rid of it, which a lot of people are asking, hey, please get rid of this or let me hide it. Instead of doing that, they just made it so they're just transparent PNGs now, so you just see the logo only. But they didn't get rid of it. So it's just like, okay, what are we doing? So there's also certain features on the mobile version that's not on the PC version in terms of like, on the mobile version, you can actually have it auto-run to, like, get to the destinations. You can just press and, like, tap on, like, a GPS icon on the mobile version, and the game will auto-run for you towards, like, the destination that you have set in place. Which, you know, kind of handy. Like, sure, why not? But no, all the movement on the PC version has to be manual. There's no way to auto-run to a destination. And one feature I wish they ported over from the mobile to PC version was in the mobile version, you can just hold the attack button, so the characters would always just keep on attacking. You just have to hold it. You don't have to tap it. But that feature is only available on the mobile version and not the PC version. PC version, you have to manually tap the attack button. And it's not the craziest thing in the world, but I'm like, if there's an option to like hold it, but only in one version, why didn't you just make the features universal?
It sounds like a job for a turbo controller or a function key on your keyboard. That's what I think.
Yeah. And that's kind of the lowdown on Mongol Star. Right? Like I put more hours into it than I think I did. I guess I just want to see the main story through, the main story available right now. I think I have like one chapter left. I just got done with episode 4, and I think there's like episode 5 is the last one. So I have to do like side quests and then do episode 5, and then maybe I'm done. I think it's also very weird too, in terms of like its world setting, where it's like first it starts out like in a fantasy setting, and like, you know, everyone is somewhat dressed appropriately for that fantasy setting. But then you get to like the next region is like sort of emblematic of like Chinese structure and architecture and whatnot there.
That's Sura.
It's like you start, it's like Nak Wan or whatever. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Because in my interview, they were talking about a region called Sura, which is Korean inspired. And I just wanted to make sure you weren't getting like Chinese and Korean mixed up.
Oh, yeah. It's a different area. I really apologize if I'm getting them mixed up.
But I'm pretty sure the Korean area is Sura.
Yeah, I bet like Nakw.
Okay. A different place. Okay.
Yeah. And they start introducing some of the main antagonist faction in. And these main antagonist factions look like they're from another game. They have like sci-fi suits. Like one is like a pink body tight suit girl on it. And the other one is like has like a this sci-fi headset like headwear on her. And like they just look like from a completely different game. So like when you first saw them, like what the fuck is happening? It was enough to like kind of get like take you out of the setting. Like what are we doing? So like it was a really funny seeing them for the first time there, which I'm sure they're gonna be banner characters as well down the road. It's okay. I mean, like I said, just if you're able to push through the upfront monetization and you know reminding you like all the cool ways you can pay for the game, it's totally okay.
And the last game that we have listed here for this week, in a surprisingly packed week, this is a game that released, I think, earlier in the month. It's Dosa Divas. Mikhail, you put this on the list as something you wanted to speak to.
Yeah, so So it's from the developers of Thirsty Suitors, and Dosa Divas is this linear JRPG, or like turn-based RPG, which is inspired by Octopath and Bravely Default's combat. But it has this whole food theme throughout, so the progression revolves around food, the narrative revolves around food, even the battles, you use food quite a bit, and all the attacks are themed after food. So you're basically controlling these two sisters and their mech who are trying to take down their other sister who's basically given up on cooking and gone into this world where everything is like not like post-apocalyptic, but this like dystopian world where no one actually cooks food anymore. Everyone just has like tasteless paste to get the nutrients and stuff, and everyone gets everything delivered. No one actually puts love into their food anymore. So it has this like this family or like family cozy vibe thing in the beginning. And it's a like I wasn't sure what to expect when I played it, because I did the demo before I interviewed Eka, who's the main like the producer, director, designer at Outer Loop, and like I've now played the full game twice. So I wasn't sure what to expect in its structure, because Thirsty Suitors is a game which they kind of like blended in 5 or 6 different genres together, and it didn't fully pay out, and it felt a bit jank, but not in too bad a way. But for this one, I think they've been more focused and stuff. So like I did not feel like my time was being wasted at all. I finished the game the first time in about 9 hours, and aside from one bug where I got stuck and I had to reload a save, everything felt like properly polished. And they also have this very good so like I'll just go across the structure. So you begin where you get introduced to the antagonist, who's your other sister, and she basically wants the future to be controlled by her food company, which is called Lena Works, and you want to make everyone realize that home-cooked food is actually the way forward. And you're also trying to look for your parents. And this journey takes you start in this place called Buroth Village, which is like a play on broth. And like they have this throughout the game. Like you have one of the attacks is called a walkerang, where you use an actual walk and you like hit it back and forth as you take down enemies and stuff. So,
and also it's worth mentioning, yeah, that your mech is like a food truck mech.
Just, yeah. Just, so just this to is fit the mech is called, the vibe. Yeah. the mech, I should be clear about that. The mech is called Goddess, and this plays like a mythical element in the story. But yeah, it's a food truck, and they've also gotten this. So for people who don't know that in like India and Pakistan and stuff around here, you have all the trucks where like the people who use like trucks and like drive them all over the country, they have this thing called horn okay please, which is like painted over the truck. It's a specific phrase, and like they all have this colorful design. So what they did for this is, because the mech is a food truck, they also got that horn okay please written over there. And as you progress through the game, you unlock more skins, and they've try to keep that authentic as well. So you have like, I think I unlocked like 10 skins by the end, and all of them had like a different variation of this, and some of them are themed after like there's a Gundam theme skin also, which is really nice. But yeah, your main party is one fighter, one tank, and one mage essentially, and you basically walk around each of the locations. There are three main locations. You have to help some of the NPCs over there. Most of them just ask you for like different dosas or different food, so you have to like go around, beat up the Lena Works goons who are trying to like get you to not come after her. And as you do this, you discover more ingredients, you find more recipes. And this is like another element where they've gotten from different they've taken different elements from other RPGs, where the cooking is a series of mini games, and this is randomized. So like you can have one where you have to like keep mashing A on a specific pattern, or the other one where you have to like move the left analog stick to keep the cursor in a specific location. So you have this where you choose the ingredients for making the dosa, and depending on how you've done the mini games, your dosa, you'll either be rewarded with more of it, or you'll get a better dosa, which gives you like better healing or whatever. So as you do this in combat, you take down goons, you also level up. And as you level up over here, they have like different systems put into it, where you level up the location or the village, and you level up yourself as well. And as you help people in the village and you do side quests, so you just like clean up the village, you can like destroy posters and stuff, you unlock more skills. So you're incentivized to actually help the people in the village beyond just grinding for yourself to level up, because that's how you get more skills. And what I didn't realize when I finished the first location is, and there's like a really cool boss fight, which they've posted about on social quite a bit. But what I didn't realize is they have like three different upgrade systems with skills and all. And I was actually impressed with how none of it felt like it was padding. Everything I was doing in the game slowly contributed to getting me stronger, unlocking more skills, and even giving me this, giving me abilities where I could go back to previous locations and take down posters or enemies which I couldn't reach before. So I was quite impressed with this. Although you can't visit previous locations until like maybe 2/3 into the main story. So the other thing I wanted to touch on is they also have fishing thrown into it, because like apparently you have to have fishing in an RPG now. So they have a fishing mini game, they have a cooking mini game, they have like a bit of exploration, they have like hidden chests all around. But the main theme is basically food, and like how you're trying to like reunite your family. But there's also this element of one of your party members, Amani, she's sick. So basically they remind you like on and off that, you know, like I'm not feeling well and stuff like that. So that is one of the major things which I wasn't happy with how they handled it. Because when you finish the story, there's one specific plot point which I felt was kind of rushed. And that's the only aspect of the game I came away from a bit annoyed. I'm not usually one to like, you know, like let one small story beat ruin the whole experience, but I feel like this was kind of poorly handled, where you built up to a moment for like three locations, lot of characters, leveling up your mech, leveling up your character and all, and suddenly one point just felt like it was rushed towards the end. So I don't know, I hope this is something they can like patch or something, because they've already been patching it quite a bit since the demo released. And the final thing I want to talk about with Dosa Divas is the music. So while the game itself pulls from like, you know, South India, you have dosas which are from here and stuff like that. And then they also have elements from JRPGs. With the music, what they did is Ramsey, the composer, he took elements of like instruments you'd hear over here locally, but also with like electronica, synth and metal. But instead of just being like, you know, a hybrid or whatever of these two things, it blends into the thing. So you have this like a drum called the dhol over here. So what he did is for a boss battle, it starts out with the traditional sound, but then it moves into the synth version. And I really like the transition over there. Like, I haven't heard Indian instruments transitioning into like electronica like that ever before. Like, obviously there's genre blends and all, but I feel like this transition is really, really nice how he handled it in the boss fights. And I think that, I don't know if the demo is still available. There's this bad trend I've noticed on Steam where indie devs will have a demo available for 2 months or whatever, but they'll delist it the moment the game goes up. Let me just check if the demo is there. Yeah, the demo is still there. So I think if you're interested in playing like a short narrative focused turn-based RPG and you like food, this is worth checking out. The demo is like a good slice of the game. They let you play quite a bit, so I really, really enjoyed. I've been listening to the music quite a bit since the soundtrack dropped on Steam when it released, so really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, I shouldn't have this wish listed as well as people of note. There's just so many I have replaced that also recently came out that I have wish listed. There's just a lot of games are coming out and there's like no freaking time to get around to them, but I hope I do later on.
I'll say one thing though, like, I was surprised that a game like this with a lot of hand-drawn art and like a very colorful aesthetic with like 2D things, when I booted it up on my ultra-wide monitor, it actually had full ultra-wide support for like whole game, so that was like pretty impressive. So yeah it's a very good PC port also, so like whenever you get around to it, it'll be like really good on PC, like no complaints.
Yeah, like ultra-wide support is still kind of, you know, hit and miss these days, so it's nice to see whenever people actually supported at launch natively. Like, I'm thinking also like other games like on my wish list, like Homura Hime and like Unbeatable, I believe it's called, like at least like late last year.
Yeah, you were smart about that. I saw so many people praise Unbeatable and I bought it and I'm not even booted it up, so like you're smart.
Yeah, I know it had to get patched. Like, there was that, like, my friend definitely was like, wait on patches or this one, but I don't know what state it is in now, but I think it's probably at a better state.
Yeah, I remember good things about it. Yeah, I remember when Unbeatable dropped, I had a mutual who had some mild criticism of it on Blue Sky and then got like kind of like subtweeted for being critical of an indie game's design decisions, and that kind of just rubbed me the wrong way, and I haven't tried it. It's like, it's, I don't know, man. That's okay, a bit weird.
I see. Yeah. Okay, well, As I discussed with Brian earlier, I'm gonna step out for now. Hopefully my throat has been through the ringer this week. Hopefully it wasn't too bad, but I step out for now. You guys enjoy the rest of the pod.
No, thanks, Josh. Yeah, and that basically, like, we had a kind of a front loaded podcast today in our games we've been playing section, and yeah, like April and like. So far in late March were surprisingly like packed for releases. So cool that we got a chance to look in at Dosa Divas and other games on my list are games like Esoteric Ebb and People of Note. So, you know, when we find time, we'll get to those. Yeah, for news, not a ton here, but I figured we'd go through them. And there's a few interesting nuggets.
I think before we go to news, just like the article, just one small thing I want to talk about.
You just added that to the outline. No, okay, that's fine. Okay, one comparison.
No, I added it before. Hades 2. I made a change.
Okay, Hades 2 released just in this last week for PlayStation and oh, what's the other one? Xbox.
Yeah, so Hades 2, I had a chance to play the PS5 and Xbox version, so I revisited all the prior versions as well. Pretty fantastic conversion by them. Like, it's just like 4K 120, feels flawless and stuff. So if you haven't gotten Hades yet, not only do they have new ports, but they also did a major patch, which, like, I expected them to do some sort of patch because, like, you know, every time there's a new release, you do something. But they literally added a new game mode. So if you've actually beaten Hades before on Switch and PC, like, boot up the game, there's like a shitload more waiting for you. So I think this is like one of those places where if you hadn't played it yet, now is the best time to get into it. So yeah, if you're curious how it compares, my comparison. And I also did a massive update of my Switch 2 handheld boost mode feature. Like, I added like, I think 15 or 16 games I tested in that. So I'm still maintaining that. Probably, like, I was hoping to do an update each week, but it takes a lot of time. So I'm going to be doing that every month. So if you're curious about Switch 1 games, like, I tested all random stuff. Centennial Case, Saga, Scarlet Grace Ambitions, and a lot of stuff. So give that a read if you play on Switch 2, because there are a lot of RPGs which are still Switch 1 only. So yeah, that big update I just pushed out for that article.
Yeah, and there's even a trailer for some of the new voice acting for some of that new content that they dropped with those versions. Yeah, and also just a programming note, Hayes also did need to step out as we go into the new section. So thank you to, of course, Josh and Hayes for leading the talk to Pragmata, which led off the podcast. All right. I really had no idea which headline to list like first here. So I just led with this one because there's really not a lot to talk about on it. Sony has announced a new video game related adaptation for their movie studios. They are working on a Bloodborne animated movie. So I know for a lot of people, they're really excited about this. For some people, they don't care because it's not Bloodborne 2. But do we have any strong opinions on this? I kind of don't, but I'm just curious where we stand on a Bloodborne movie.
I you know why I posted it. I literally just care about it so I could post that Sony has announced a new Bloodborne as the headline. Yep. And like, that's all. I don't care about it beyond that.
It could be good. Like, I mean, I hope it's good. That's all I can really say.
Yeah, we don't really have any other details. I did not watch the what event was this? Sorry,
it wasn't. CinemaCon. I think they just it was one of, they had some other announcements like a Helldivers 2 thing also. But yeah, like it, it's just because Bloodborne. That's why I posted it.
Yeah, but like as far as I can tell, and please correct me if I'm missing something. No, obviously no trailer, but no like talent, no director, no like.
Jacksepticeye is producing it, and it's at Sony Pictures. They did say I think that. That's all we know. Yeah, that's all. Mm-hmm. That's all that's been said about it. And it's an R-rated animated thing. That's all.
It's interesting that it's becoming a trend now for content creators to now like produce video game film adaptations. I mean, because Iron Lung was man, wasn't it like mostly just Markiplier that did that one?
Yeah, that's who. That's, yeah, at least he's the.
Yeah, he was. He funded it, and I actually spoke to the composer about Iron Lung.
Fund it, direct it, edit it, and he was like the one main act. Like there was more than one. He wasn't the only actor, but he was like the main actor. So, which is interesting. Yep. I actually saw it. It was pretty decent. So. Mm-hmm.
And then the other one I put up here is kind of like a major headline. It's because just this is a headline I just would not expect to see. I figured this was going to be like a long, you know, a pie in the sky sort of thing. All right. Xenosaga Pied Piper. If you don't know what that is, it is a mobile phone game from like the feature phone era, like pre-iPhone, early 2000s, where... Japanese video game studios release games for their feature phones that would tie into their, you know, their console series at the times. And these would almost invariably never get localized because the phones that we had couldn't support them. There was no like global market like iPhone and Android have now. So a lot of these, like what was the Final Fantasy one that followed the Turks before Crisis? That was another one from that same era. But anyways, the bearing the lead here, G-Mode is bringing Xenosaga Pied Piper and Namco Chronicle, a game that I know less about, admittedly, to Switch and Steam. And Pied Piper is an interesting game because it is a prequel to the Xenosaga trilogy, which is a trilogy of RPGs from, you know, on the PlayStation 2. That the way that was framed is that in Xenosaga 3, the story events are delivered in a way that presumes that you have knowledge of Pied Piper when anyone playing that game in English did not. So they're like, what's the deal with between Ziggy and Voyager and how is Kanan, or I think it's his name, like related to this? Like, I feel like I'm missing something. It's like, yep, you're missing a whole prequel that explained half of this.
Yeah, Xenosaga 3 just basically assumes you know you played this.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a prequel that stars Ziggy, who he's a human at this and during the prequel, but he's like a I forget the in-game term for it in Xenosaga, but he's a android, or I guess cyborg is the more correct term in the trilogy. So coming to PC and Steam. Now I don't know if we really got much in like other details about like the release cadence for these. I'm trying to dig through the Steam page to see it. Like it's still going to just be in Japanese, though. I'm sure, you know, now that's on Steam, that opens the door for like fan patches and all sorts of things. And I'm sure if you dig far enough, like that's probably something that's already available, but this will just make it a little bit more like conducive for people who want to play that game. But I don't know, something that I never thought that I would ever see. I thought that was kind of a bygone era, that it was just kind of be like a loss to the annals of history, but it'll be playable in a modern format soon. All right, in terms of other headlines this week, so there was an event that I wasn't familiar with. Adam, I'm not sure if you were, called the Galaxies Showcase. Like I'm not exactly sure who puts this together, but they've had two or three showcases at this point, showcasing both like indie games but also like big publishers. Like they've partnered with studio like Konami and Namco and Focus Entertainment, like not all just indie titles. So we had a few trailers and updates from a Galaxy Spring Showcase 2026, and there were a few other small showcases like GameStar's Find Your Next Game. So we a lot of trailers here that we'll just kind of quickly rattle through as we close out this podcast.
Yeah, I'm actually not sure like who Galaxies is like affiliated with. But
I went to their website to see like if I could find, and basically they have like, you know, if you're a content creator and you've got a platform on Twitch and YouTube, you know, you can become a co-streamer, like you can like get in that space and actually get like involved in that. But in terms of like how they're getting, you know, through what vehicle they're getting the publishers on board, I'm not sure, but still some pretty cool updates, a lot of them in the RPG space, hence why we're talking about them today. But outside of those showcases, a few other trailers. We have a new Final Fantasy 14 patch coming up on April 28th, at least the first part of it. This is the Final Fantasy 14 patch 7.5, Trail to the Heavens. James, you're the best person equipped to speak to what you guys are expecting out of 7.5.
So it's going to be the last major patch of Dawn Trail. Obviously, we are quickly approaching expansion season, like new expansion. Like next week, mm-hmm. we will know what that expansion is. I don't know if I'll be on the podcast next week because FanFest is Friday and Saturday. There isn't anything on the schedule that necessitates me to be there like during the podcast, but there might be another obligation I have to do. So we'll see.
I mean, you don't gotta like, you know, enjoy FanFest. Like,
well, no. I mean, my mean is that, yeah, true. But it's a little bit different because this time it's in Anaheim. It's like a 15-20 minute drive for me. So it's not as big of a deal as when it was in Vegas, when it's like, okay, it would be on shitty hotel Wi-Fi and all that.
They're calling in from your phone.
Yeah. So, getting the last bit, well, the first half of the last bit of MS main scenario quests. We're getting the dungeon, we're getting the trial. Then later in the patch cycle, we're getting the new ultimate raid. Well, also at the launch of 7.5, at the end of the month, we're also getting the final alliance raid in the alliance raid series. But later on in the patch cycle, we'll be getting the ultimate raid. We're going to be getting the second half of Occult Crescent. We're going to be getting a PvP updates. We're going to be getting undetailed. It's announced, but not detailed what exactly it is, like Gold Saucer update. So I'm assuming it's going to be some sort of collaboration again. And the reason they're being coy is it's going to be at FanFest. And then there's other things like relic weapons and stuff. But the most interesting thing about this live letter isn't even necessarily to do a 7.5, but there's been a number of pretty radical system changes that they've started adding to the game in terms of glamour and in terms of dyes. And they've explicitly said that starting with 7.5 and moving into 8.0, that they are deliberately going to re-examine and completely change how some aspects of the game work, and they're not just going to like stick to tradition as they have done in the past. So we don't know what 8.0 is going to be, but they're both talking the talk and walking the walk in terms of, okay, they're actually trying to make some pretty massive changes. Like, even for content that, for most people, doesn't matter. Like, they haven't fully detailed what the new Ultimate Raid is, but in previous expansions and in previous Ultimate Raids, there was a roughly accepted cadence where it would be a main scenario, then the raid series. Raid series, main scenario, and back and forth, going through the expansions. They changed things up a little bit with the last Ultimate, Futures Rewritten, but most people kind of assume the reason why they did that is that it wouldn't have made sense to do a Stormblood main scenario Ultimate, since Stormblood's main thing is Xenos. And it would have made a lot more sense to just wait until Endwalker to have like a Xenos Ultimate, so you can incorporate the stuff that Xenos does in Endwalker. So they did the Shadowbringers raid like Ultimate first, and people were assuming that the next one was going to be the Shadowbringers main scenario, but instead, the tease has made it clear that is absolutely not what they're doing, and instead they're doing something to do with Kefka, which makes some sense, because TOP, which was the Omega Protocol, which was the Stormblood raid, Ultimate raid, only really focused on Omega, so like the last two fights of that raid series. And the thing with the Omega raid series is that it was a big like kind of self-referential, because you had stuff like references to Final Fantasy V, references to Final Fantasy VI, references to all these other Final Fantasies. So we don't know if the Kefka teaser means it's going to be like a bunch of old Final Fantasy bosses, and it's going to be like a kind of who's who of Final Fantasy final bosses in an Ultimate Raid, or if it's going to be Kefka and the Warring Triad, because the Warring Triad does exist in Final Fantasy 14, but it's not tied to Kefka, so it's just very different. It's very different, so combine that with the dye changes and the stuff that they're changing with the Glamour Dresser, and the fact they've said that they're also going to be changing the way that totems work for extreme trials to get mounts, and also how the relic weapons work. And they've explicitly said that with the next expansion forward, they're going to change how those work entirely. It's like, it's a very exciting time to be a 14 fan, because especially since Dawn Trail was a little bit disappointing, it does seem like the team is trying to go back to basics and rethink a lot of core aspects of the game, and it makes me excited to see exactly where that is heading.
Yeah, and it's like whenever you're playing a long-running game, whenever like those nuts and bolts are looked at in terms of changing fundamental like parameters, always can be kind of scary, but you know, hopefully in service of the greater good. In Guild Wars, they recently just did like a big DPS nerf across the board, across all classes, because power creep had basically made it unwieldy. And that, of course, you know, made a lot of players upset, but it was kind of in service of trying to rebalance the game and tweak a bunch of things and make a lot of similar changes. So it's something that I wish more long-running games did more of more often. And it takes a lot of bravery in order to do that. So it'd be really interesting to see what gets formally announced.
I really hope if they're serious about retooling a bunch of these old systems, the number one thing they need to change is how level sync works. Because there's two problems. First off, they need to make it so that players get access to their full rotation or more of the rotation earlier, because there's so many classes in the game right now that don't get full access to a rotation until like halfway through level 70, which means if you're someone new playing the game for the first time, you're not actually going to know how to play your class until you're like over 200 hours into the game, which is wild. And
because you just don't have access to like your talents or skills that you would actually use until high level. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and then it also makes it like leveling up any additional jobs even more of a pain in the ass, because it's like, okay, they don't have a full rotation, so you're going to be bored out of your mind if you're used to playing jobs that have a full rotation at max level. It's like, not every job is super bad about this. Some are better than others, but this has been a problem for the last couple of expansions. It's been a problem ever since I started playing the game effectively in Shadowbringers. So if they are going back to readjust stuff, like some core elements of the game, I think level sync is the number one thing they should fix, especially since I did 2 years ago check out World of Warcraft, and finding out how they handled level sync really made me upset with how Final Fantasy XIV kind of doesn't. For context, the way that WoW handles it is that they nerf your potencies of your abilities, and they kind of normalize how much damage you're doing in dungeons or like older content, but you still have access to your full kit because you're still essentially that same like max level, but your potencies are adjusted instead of like losing access to your shit. 14, when they level sync you, it's like, no, you only have access to the abilities you would have at this level, even if it would be fucking miserable. And there's some people for the longest time that have said, oh, well, that'll make all these this old content just pointless, or, well, it'll make it like trivial. And it's like, old content already is trivial because you have like new food, you have like the way that the level sync works still doesn't really fully account for the fact that you're just going to have better gear. If shit's already trivial, just make it so that it's not going to be annoying if you're trying to help your friend that's still in the Realm Reborn get through the content that you're only pressing effectively 3, maybe 4 buttons at a time. Like,
I think I noticed this level sync thing because I was playing Realm Reborn and Heavensward like quite a bit later than everyone else I used to play with. So it seemed like they force you into level sync just for like, maybe I think in Realm Reborn story, it was like 4 encounters totally. So like, if you're even, you know, if you pay for a level boost yourself, like they sell those boosts, you can basically just overpower and one hit kill everything. But suddenly they'll be like, oh no, you can't do that over here. Suddenly you have to actually pay attention. And I've been playing Diablo 4 recently. I feel like that also handles it better, because whatever the level of anyone is, they will like scale the enemies like on the fly so that they will still have some sort of challenge, even though like they're high level and you're not high level, so everyone will still feel like they're contributing. I think FF14 does not do that.
It does not, yeah. But yeah, I do think that there is a bunch of things that the team should be looking at, and considering how open they've been about, oh no, there's a bunch of like spaghetti code for years, and the fact that they're slowly getting to stuff that absolutely would have been under that spaghetti code makes me hopeful that the idea that Dawn Trail was a safe expansion outside the graphical update was specifically to buy themselves time for the next expansion. Because if that ends up being the case, then I think people are going to be a lot more forgiving of some of Dawn Trail's issues. It's always a bit rough talking about the main scenario for Dawn Trail because there's very real issues. But a lot of the people that talk about that are most annoyingly talking about it are transphobic because of Wuk Lamott's voice actress is trans. So it's tough to talk around, because even if there are very real issues with it, you don't want to elevate those talking points and whatnot. So,
yeah, no, we run into that, I wouldn't say frequently, but it's not uncommon where it's just like where criticism comes from is important. Like, whenever we rate a game poorly, we try to substantiate it in ways that explain where we're coming from, and not because of an agenda against an actor or a writer or a theme that we disagree with, you know, things like that. And so when you're trying to say like, I criticize it for this reason, but not for something like how the voice actor identifies, of course, that's not, you know, something we're factoring in. So I get where you're coming from completely.
Yep. But yeah, next week, less than a week until the keynote, like next Friday, we'll know what the next expansion is. We'll know where we're going. And they've even said that they're purposefully revealing more about the expansion early this time, to the point where they're basically going to spoil a major part of 7.5, which is interesting. Because Yoshi-P's outright said that people are going to be like, you're showing this now when 7.5 isn't even out yet? So I'm excited to see what that means.
One other trailer. This is one that locked in a release date of something we were very interested in. The Trails in the Sky, Trails in the Sky, second chapter. We knew that it was coming out in the fall. We were pretty much going to guess September. We got an official date from Falcom and Gung Ho. It'll be launching on September 17th alongside the release date. We got a release date trailer as well as a recap of some of the English voice actors for many of the characters.
It's actually worth noting that a couple of characters are recast.
Oh, go into that. I didn't catch that.
George Weissman is now Liam O'Brien. And which is kind of a pull, because Liam O'Brien is a veteran voice actor, not a newcomer or upcoming voice, been in a lot of stuff. Was voiced by David Lodge originally. Now that voice maybe sort of works because that character kind of changes character between the two games, sort of. Still, I'm not saying it's ideal, but he was voiced by David Lodge in first chapter, now Liam O'Brien in second chapter. Makes me wonder if he's gonna pull out some of his Lezard Valeth voice. I mean, Liam O'Brien is Liam O'Brien, but he's done kind of these villain types before, so I think in some way it's suitable. But also, Leonhardt or Lawrence or whoever, that character was voiced by Travis Willingham in first chapter and is now voiced by Stephen Fu in second chapter. Which Stephen Fu, I think he was the voice of the Trials, or not Trials, Visions of Mana main character. Which is a very different voice. I'm not very familiar with this actor, so I'm not sure, do they fit this character? I don't know, but it's kind of unfortunate. I'd rather, there be consistency in the voices, but there's a couple of recasts, and that is what it is, I guess, for the English dub.
No, good chat.
Yeah, so they announced this at, I believe it was probably towards the night US time, and it was around the afternoon my time. So I was just randomly online and I see notification Trails in the Sky second chapter release date. And I was I posted about it as soon as I could because breaking news for us or whatever. And then I went to, because I was waiting for the pre-orders to go live, because in Japan you can't actually take pre-orders for a game until you have a release date. This is apparently some rule they have over there. And I was hoping they put up the collector's edition. So they did. And I went to Amazon Japan and I was let me order it as soon as I can before they change the shipping so that they don't ship outside Japan, because that happens quite a bit. So I ordered it, and as soon as I ordered it, I got a call saying, did you use your verification call from the bank? And I was why did they call me for an order which is months away? And then I saw the fine print on the page that this is an order. Once you've ordered it, you cannot cancel it. So it was one of those things. So I'm locked in now for Trails in the Sky second chapter on PS5. So yeah, that was super funny, because the collector's edition, which there was a lot of drama with the first game's collector's edition because it was limited run games. Chao got it, I think, last week or something. We've joked about second chapter coming out before the collector's edition for the first one releases, but at least limited run games wasn't that bad about it. So yeah, they put up the pre-orders in Japan. And the other thing of note that they've not confirmed for the West is the console-only pre-orders in Japan include an HD remaster of Trails in the Sky first chapter, Trails in the Sky FC, essentially, which I assume is going to be the PSP HD thing they did on PS3. They're going to port it over. So that is available as a pre-order bonus, not for Steam, just for PlayStation, Switch 2 and Switch 1. So I thought that was pretty notable, because Clouded Leopard Entertainment has confirmed it's going to be included in the Asia version. But what do you think? Are we going to get this through Xseed later on as a paid thing? Is it never going to come over, or what's happening?
I don't know. I think it would be... I think it would be awkward, because which translation would they use? Because Falcom owns the Xseed translation, so they could technically use the Xseed translation. But if I were Gung Ho, I would maybe not want to have those two directly comparable easily.
Yeah, I see that, but it's just bizarre that like Gung-Ho was the one that revealed the existence of a season pass for Trails in the Sky second chapter. Like, we obviously knew it was going to happen when they did it for the first one, but they put that up before there was any information here, and now you have a pre-order bonus here, but we don't know what's the pre-order bonus for the West yet. So it's just bizarre that like what should have been like a slam dunk release where everyone is happy, they're just like either not revealing stuff in time, and then they messed up some editions again in the West. So like, it's just annoying that this keeps happening.
And Mikhail, you were gonna head off
I'll
it is the middle of the night for you. Yeah,
yep,
so
it's 2 a.m.
Have a good
sleep. So thank you. Yeah,
have a good night. Sleep. All right. Yes, there's still a number of headlines here, but a lot of these are trailers, which on this podcast we'll kind of just have to touch on and move on. So at the Galaxy Spring Showcase, we did get an announcement of Kataria Fables 2. This is a follow-up to Kataria Fables, which released, I believe, in 2021. Kind of like one of those initial farming sim action RPG hybrids from that era. It sold pretty well, the first one, so it's not surprising to see that they followed up with a sequel. There's multiple playable characters. Otherwise, I can't really speak to it directly because I never played the original.
Yeah, they say it's a direct sequel, but it stars a new set of characters. So like,
yeah,
you know, it's in the same continuity, but you're playing as different, you know, people. And they're all animals, by the way. So if we haven't said that,
yeah, they're all anthropomorphic. There's like two main characters that each play slightly differently. Alice Skylar and Dusty Tufkin are
those are definitely animal names. Well, at least the second one.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it does support like local and online co-op between the two characters.
Oh yeah, because it's like you play as the two characters sort of simultaneously, or you know, you toggle between the two. So you can either play it, you know, by yourself, kind of switching between the two characters, or just play in co-op.
Mm-hmm. A few other games that had a look in at the Galaxy Spring Showcase. The Sword Art Online game, Echoes of Einrad, basically got a new trailer. Honestly, I don't know the game well enough to like dive into what's shown here, but it was explicitly a gameplay trailer. So primarily looking at the game from that perspective.
I don't really care about SAO. In fact, I think SAO is pretty bad overall. But I kind of get what they're going for here. Like, the game title is just called Echoes of Einrad. And I've seen people like get confused about this. Like, wait, what is that? Like, oh, it's the SAO game, because it doesn't actually say Sword Art Online in the title. And, you know, the premise of the game is that it's like you are a character or a person who's playing this MMO, kind of caught up in this, in the SAO premise where you're like stuck in the game. So you're like, you're just some other person in the game. And yeah, you might see or meet, you know, Kirito or Asuna or whatever. Since you're like someone else in that world. So it's like, I get that's kind of the framing they're going for, which maybe that's why they didn't put SAO in the title. But that's the idea anyways. It's like, you're also just caught up in that premise.
A couple of the other indie games that showed up at this showcase. The action RPG platformer Second Stone got a new trailer. This was first shown off, I think, earlier this year. It's from,
Finnish?
Polish studio?
Finnish.
Yes. And it's they call it an RPG platformer hybrid. When it was announced, their inspirations were explicitly listed as games like Zelda, Jak and Daxter, and also Bloodborne. So there you go. So we got a new look in during the event. Forever is another game that was shown at the Galaxy Showcase. It's coming into early access on May 6th. This is like an online multiplayer game where it's like you and three friends. I think it's three friends. It showed us four characters. Kind of have like a mini RPG world to explore that has like a big crafting component as well. So it's class-based. It talks about how in early access it'll have so much content compared to the planned full release in terms of, you know, weapons and regions and things like that. So it seems like if you have a couple friends and you kind of want like a kind of a goofy look at like a fantasy setting, looks like it could be a pretty fun time. There was also an event called GameStar's Find Your Next Game. I think the only thing we pulled out of it is another trailer for Shadow of the Road. This is from Another Angle Games. It's one of the first games being published by Owlcat, other than their own titles, of course. Shadow of the Road, we've talked about a few times on the podcast as kind of like an alternate history 19th century Japan turn-based RPG. And I will say that the more I see of this game, the more I'm interested in it, in terms of it reminds me a lot of how like Wasteland, at least Wasteland 3, was set up. In terms of, like, it's got that isometric perspective. Apparently, it stars two characters. So that's very Wasteland 3 to me, where you pick a pair of characters to kind of, like, create as your protagonist. But you do get other characters along with your party. This new trailer from the GameStar event shows, like, more dialogue and more, like, actual, like, RPG kind of mechanics. And the voiceover for the trailer talks about how that impacts the story. So it's really starting to feel like it's coming together. So this is a game, the more I see of it, the more I'm kind of excited for it. There's also been a lot of games, I feel like, set in this era of Japan recently, kind of like the 1800s, Meiji Restoration. Like, obviously, it's kind of a very... there's a lot of stories to pull in from that era of Japan, so I'm not surprised. But just recently, saw it in Rise of the Ronin, in Neo 3, in that one Yakuza game from a couple years ago. Like, it's a fun era to revisit.
I don't want to be too cynical, but one thing that kind of like I can't like shake completely from this game is that it's like I think like Russian or Cyprus developers like making like a feudal Japan game. And I'm just kind of like, you know,
that's a good point.
How yeah. authentic is this, you know, or is it just kind of like your wishful thinking, you know, like Japan cool type thing? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, what if samurais and robots? Like, isn't that neat? Yeah, but
It's one of those. It makes me think of like BioWare making Jade Empire, which is like a bunch of white Canadians making a Chinese mythology RPG, and you're just like, not that Jade Empire is terrible, but it's just kind of like something to keep in mind.
Yeah. We also got just another very quick Owlcat update. Of course, they are working on both DLC for Rogue Trader, as well as the upcoming Warhammer 40K Dark Heresy. And they recently just revealed new companions for both of those games. I love Owlcat companions. I think they're some of the best in the business in terms of not being like too archetypal or too stereotyped. But I will say like individual character drops really don't do a ton for me. But I do think that the cast of Rogue Trader is pretty fun for that setting. And I'm excited to eventually revisit that game to see all the new characters they added and all the DLCs. So yeah, the Rogue Trader character is one they're adding with the third DLC, Infinite Museon. I don't know Warhammer. I don't know how it's pronounced. But yeah, working hard on both those games. A couple small updates. Granblue Fantasy Relink, the upcoming Endless Ragnarok kind of re-release of that game, is getting an open beta test next week. Adventures of Elliot is another game that we have circled on our calendar for later this year. Adam, you just kind of compiled kind of a big Square Enix newsletter dump for some of the things they detailed on that. And this is not the first one we've seen for Adventures of Elliot. Is there any big key takeaways here?
I have a correction that I for myself.
Yeah.
So like Adventures of Elliot is a time travel game. There's four different eras that they're talking about, and I even mentioned we've previously had like overviews of two of them. There's two more to go. Well, here's the third one now, which is the Age of Magic. Now, I kind of assumed last time, like, oh, there's like your present time, then there's past, future, and then like prehistory or whatever, right? I was wrong. You actually start in present time. You go back to the past, and it's like desolate era. I forget what it's called. I don't have the name in front of me, but it's like ruined past. And then you go further back in the past to the Age of Magic. It's not in the future. I made that assumption last time, and that brings up, and they actually explicitly say this in this media kit here, is, you know, you go back to the Age of Magic, which is further back in the past, which is kind of like a utopia, everything's great, you know, tied to society, but you know, like, what comes next, like, okay, something's gonna go wrong here, and this society's gonna fail, so that's kind of like on the back of your mind as you're exploring this era, the Age of Magic, and then the next age is even further back in the past, which I assume will be the May media kit before the release in June. So yeah, it's a time travel game. It's got, you know, the HD 2D style and the action RPG, you know, gameplay. This update also introduces like phase magic training, which it looks like that's just kind of a fancy kind of setting for mini games. There's like some like point collecting or time trial type things that you can do. So it'll be kind of interesting how that all fits in to the game.
No. So basically the present is the furthest. Everything is back in the past.
Yeah, you're going back and back. Okay. So like the premise of the game is like the princess of the present has like a disease or some sort of affliction. And like that's the original goal is to try to like solve that. But I'm assuming it becomes something greater. And it somehow involves time going back in the past and seeing the era of things. And I'm assuming that all you know, coalesce into some big conflict. But yeah, that's generally seems to be what you're going for.
All right. We have the weekly sales update. Crimson Desert has sold over 5 million copies. I don't think we're surprised. Just a couple release dates. There's a game called Memolith Forsaken by Light is releasing on April 2nd. Like, sorry, April 27th. My note was wrong. Releasing on April 27th. So this is a PC game that's been in early access since 2023. So just real cool to see, even though it took 3 years. Not really 3 years, 2.5 years. That game is going to be seeing a full release by the end of the month. It's a South Korean like strategy kind of based RPG. It's got like it has like a pretty intricate and detailed UI and kind of a fun pixel art style. And then Dragon Quest Smash Grow. This is like the relatively recently announced new Dragon Quest mobile title. It's going to get its formal launch April 20th here in the West, April 21st in Japan. So
new Dragon Quest game. Kind of like a roguelike battler. Seems strange. Like this Dragon Quest of all things. And they had a beta last year and some people played it and they're like, yep, it's pretty strange. I mean, I'm sure the game is fine. It just doesn't feel like something you'd expect from like the Dragon Quest series.
I never really hear anything about the Dragon Quest mobile offerings, like Dragon Quest Tact, and there was a few other ones, like Square Enix offerings or other offerings. Like I tend to hear about them, good or bad, but Dragon Quest ones, I never seem to like feel like what the reception is for those games. But yeah, Smash Grow, in just a couple of days. And that's it for this podcast. It was kind of fun to have another podcast.
I guess it's not on the doc, but something that I thought was actually pretty interesting, in a small way, interesting. So there's going to be another PlayStation Plus like catalog update next week, I think on April 21st. Horizon Zero Dawn Remastered is being added, which is, you know, whatever. But also one of the games being added is Wild Arms 4, which is interesting. So, like, Wild Arms, there's, like, 5 number titles in the series. There's a remake. There's a spinoff. Wild Arms 1 and 2 had been on, like, their PlayStation 1 games. They were on, like, the PS3 PSN. And then they eventually made their way to the PS4 PSN. Wild Arms 3 also was. Now, all of those games were, like, I believe Sony published, or at least Sony partner published, even back then. So that wasn't too surprising. Wild Arms 4... interestingly has like the fun fact that it was the very first game published in North America by Exceed. It's the very first Exceed game is Wild Arms 4.
That's fun trivia.
Yeah, back in 2006. It was shortly before Shadow Hearts Dawn of the New World one, whatever that's called. The third Shadow Hearts 3. Something of the New World? I forget. That came out like a couple months later, also from Exceed.
I'd correct you, but I don't know what it is. Something new world.
I'm gonna look this up.
Let's look it up. We gotta get it right now.
Shadow Hearts.
From the New World.
Is it just From the New World? Yeah, From the New World. I'm like something of the New World, just From the New World. Okay. Which I think is actually a perfectly okay game. It's pretty much a clone of 2 with different characters. 2 is better, but yeah. I think 3 is fine. So it's kind of interesting because it's like, oh, I guess, does Exceed have any input under this property at all anymore? Like, that was so long ago. It was obviously just like a partner thing way back when. Does Sony have control over this franchise? This is the very first time Wild Arms 4 has been available digitally. So in terms of just like a preservation aspect, it's like, hey, this is a place you can buy it. That's not just a PS2 just sitting somewhere. It'll have trophies for the first time. And it's like, well, what about Wild Arms 5? And what about the other ones? It's just kind of an interesting, like, unexpected inclusion in their library that you'll be able to buy and play it. And I don't think, you know, we expected that.
Yeah, I guess I didn't add it because a lot of times when I see those headlines about what's adding to catalogs, I'm like, yeah, you know, that's good to cover in news, but is it really podcast material? But no, that definitely is podcast material. So I'm glad you added that.
Yeah, Wild Arms 4 is kind of, it has some, it's probably one of the weaker Wild Arms games, like overall, but it has some both good ideas and also just like weird things that help it stand apart. There's a cutscene in the game where a character like jumps up in the air, propels himself with like shotguns or guns, and he like punches a missile. I'm not kidding. He just punches a missile because why not? But there's also like an interesting mechanic in the game where you're going through these dungeons and there's random encounters. And then like if you solve like in each of the locations in the game, there's like an optional puzzle you can solve in that area. And if you solve that puzzle in that area, then you are given for that area like a toggle to turn off encounters or not, to turn on or off encounters. But I thought it was just kind of like a cool idea. Like the first time you get to a zone, you have to deal with random encounters old school style. They're there. It is what it is. But once, as soon as you like find a puzzle, there's that incentive to figure that out. Then you can turn them off, which is kind of like, I still think that's a pretty interesting concept where it's like, you can't just turn them off and on whenever you want. That's too lenient, but we're not going to have you force you to do random encounters all the time. But you have to have this extra incentive to go out of your way to find a puzzle so you can then turn them off. I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting and I haven't seen many other games do that. But yeah, it's kind of a weird inclusion that I will probably play. That I didn't expect this to be available, but now it will be.
No, good shout. All right, to wrap this up, go ahead and give Hayes's Pragmata review a look through up on the site, rpgsite.net. You should bookmark our website and comment on your favorite posts. Join our Discord, discord.gg/rpgsite. Find us on social media, just search for RPG Space Site. You should be able to find us. Whenever you listen to us, give us a like, give us a rating, whether it's YouTube or whatever podcast service. We'd like to see those. We'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. We might be able to talk about Diablo. I'm not sure. RPG is 2026.
Let's see. I'd have to check.
Oh yeah, you should bookmark Mikhail. Adam's RPG list. you know, it's forever bookmarked at the top of the homepage now, so you can get to it. Let's see. Yeah, Valorborn. I've seen people excited about that entering early access.
Diablo's not out until the week after, so I don't know when that embargo is.
I'll have to double check when the embargo is. So yeah, we'll see. We'll play it by ear. But until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to y'all later.